Good morning and welcome to the September 27th, 2011 San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting. Could you please stand and join us in the flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, could you please read any changes to today's agenda?
There is an added item of closed session, one pending litigation, a conference with legal counsel existing litigation, 14 Sunny Acres Incorporated et al. Versus County of San Luis Obispo et al., CV090360. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Okay, thank you very much. We will go into our consent agenda. I have no request from the public to speak on the consent agenda, so I will... Oh, wait, we do have one from the consent agenda. Okay. Mr. Barrow, you wanted to speak on A10. If you could, please, come forward.
My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. I'm going to take these headset off. I'm not really clear on what exactly the agenda is. We're supposed to let CDM redesign the collection system, and that's going to save us $35,000, if I understood the staff report. And then Montgomery Watson will share the documents, which will then hold them harmless from any mistakes they had made on the collection system. So essentially what this is about is redesigning an already designed gravity collection system that was proposed by the Community Services District. And that would correct any oversized errors and omissions. My concern with this is that all companies like Montgomery Watson Harza have errors and omission insurance. They should be paying for this design fault or mistake, because the gravity system has been designed once by the county and was approved by the Coastal Commission in 1995, or 98. They got a coastal development permit that was put on hold. So I guess my question is, why are we indemnifying Montgomery Watson Harza when we are the ratepayers are left holding the bill? And I think that's what A10 does in this case, is that it does hold them harmless. Also, we, the ratepayers, have paid for the design. The design is the property of Los Osos CSD, and that design was turned over to the county when you did due diligence. So the county owns the design. Why does Montgomery Watson have anything to do with this? So that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Lindy Owen, on the same item, please.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos, the Prohibition Zone. I wanted to also speak to this request to approve an agreement with Montgomery Watson Harza to release and allow Camp Dresser and McKee use of electronic documents related to the CSD's past efforts for the wastewater project. Again, we paid for all of this one time, two times. This almost looks like a third time that we're asking for the details of that project that was flawed to begin with to come forward so that we can spend $5 million minimum beginning to correct the problems that came from those CAD drawings of the layout of the collection. The reason that most of us come here every week is because the collection project is flawed on this. First, it did not get a free, a clear evaluation between the less expensive, less dangerous, and less energy demanding project that you have, which is the big pipe that will be hauling raw sewage. So the idea that these drawings did not come with the money that we paid to Montgomery Watson Harza, as our community is paying over and over and over again for all these mistakes. So from the time that the project was taken over by RCSD, the money that has been spent on this is money for items that do belong to the community. Montgomery Watson Harza has no use for those documents, and they should have been turned over in the first place. So I'm not sure why we're saving $35,000 by having them turn them over at this point. They've been used as consultants with this project that you've taken on. They've been allowed to bid on this project. I don't know if you care to understand how serious the allegations in all the other communities, New Orleans, Florida has it, even Iraq. Montgomery Watson Harza has serious wrongdoings, and it's bid rigging, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that applies to what they've done to our original CSD and to this county, and to act like we're saving $35,000 for them to turn over drawings that are obsolete at this point anyway, doesn't make sense. I would just sort of look into that a little further. I don't think that it's something that you should just sign off today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And that'll close it to public comment on consent, and I'll bring it back to my colleagues at the board to see if they have any comments or questions. Mr. Teixeira?
No.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Maybe clarification on 10.
Okay. Mr. Patterson?
No, sir.
Okay. And Mr. Gibson?
We will clarify 10.
Okay. I see Mr. Waddell. Would you be so kind as to address, and I don't know, did you want more specific
fine.
Questions?
That's perfectly fine. I have no questions. I just want clarification based on the questions that were asked from the public.
Okay.
I'd be happy to. I'm John Waddell with the Public Works Department. As it says in the staff report, after CDM was brought on to work on the design, MWH has been working cooperatively with the county and with CDM at no cost to help provide provide the electronic CAD files, that were corrupt or missing, and help locate those so that CDM can move forward with the design. There were about 70. There's drawings for about 70 plan sheets that. That MWH has held back and not provided, and in working with them, their feeling was that those were plan sheets that had been revised and adjusted after the project in 2005 was in construction, and those were costs that a couple of things. Those were plan sheets that they were never paid for by the CSD when the project was canceled, and that was their contention, and also that they had not completed the formal review process within their organization and been stamped and signed by engineers, and so they felt uncomfortable in turning those over as potentially finished documents to another party. So the agreement here is just that it's a release of liability, and it's a three-party agreement between the county, MWH, and CDM. It's basically lays out the situation as it is, and that. MWH is not making any representations that those are completed engineering documents, and they're turning them over to CDM, who now is working as the county's consultant, and will make any modifications needed to those, and take the full engineering liability for any changes, for those documents in general. As far as the estimate of cost saving, that's just an estimate. Typically, on an engineering design, a sheet of plans with all the labor and engineering that goes into it is several thousand dollars per sheet. So just an estimate of the cost to take these previously done sheets, but that we just have right now, since we don't have the CAD files, the electronic drafting files. Just the time for someone to redraft those would be several hundred dollars, and so we made an estimate of the potential cost savings there. But this is not there's no cost to the county. MWH has been very cooperative, and is just wants to go ahead and provide these. We've been working with one of their staff members who had previously been involved with the project. Wants to help, wants to see the project get done, wants to see the community be able to move forward. As the last speaker said, the community is paying multiple times for the mistakes they've made, and this is a gesture by MWH to so that the community does not have to pay again for these documents.
Mr. Meacham, go ahead.
If I might, John, thank you. But you said a little bit earlier there were, 13 of the drawings that they did not?
Oh, 70.
Seven. Are they relevant to the project?
Yes.
Okay. And they are going to be able to utilize those by turning them over to CDM?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. With that, I would entertain a motion.
So, second.
Moved by Supervisor Meacham, second by Supervisor Gibson on consent. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you. Okay. Appreciate those folks who are here for consent, and we will move into public comment. And I will begin with Gina Whitaker, followed by Eric Reaney. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here today. I brought some visuals.
Okay.
But I don't think I'm going to be able to stand them up. Anyway. Okay.
Maybe Eric will hold it for you while he stands
next to you.
That's
okay. I can hold it.
There, he's ready.
Cool. Okay. I'm here today to express my concern, not with you guys, but about an article, an AP article I read in the Tribune on Saturday, called The American Allergy to Global Warming, Why? By Charles Hanley. And I'm just, some of the statements in that article were really just shocking to me, that despite the undeniable physics of global warming and the indisputable findings of 98% of climate change scientists, a huge number of Americans are continuing to deny and dispute climate change. So I'm here today to remind you and to bring you a gift that on October 30th at the Fremont Theater, Bill McKibben will be coming to speak. And tickets can be purchased at this website. But I am here from Central Coast Clergy and Laity for Justice to give you guys tickets to the event. And I hope that you'll be able to join.
Great. Thank you. Do you want to promote that website again, Gina?
Yes, this
website.
This website is rather long. It's CCC numeral 4 justice dot Eventbrite, spelled Eventbrite .com. And tickets are only $10, and we hope so much that we will sell out the Fremont, and we hope we see you guys there. On that night, October 30th of this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gina.
Yeah, and I do encourage people to attend if they can. Bill McKibben is one of the best, if not the best, writers on natural and scientific issues, I think, for the last few decades. So, Mr. Greening, Gwen Taylor, please.
Thank you, and I'd like to begin by endorsing the comments of the previous speaker. I hope that we all attend this. He has indeed been writing for decades. His first book was called The End of Nature, and it was quite a downer. It was followed by an upper talking about some honest hope in places like Curitiba, Brazil, and even New England, and he's gone on from there, including getting arrested at the White House protesting this pipeline that would allow the Canadians to essentially eviscerate the boreal forest and create fuel with such a high ecological cost that not only does it not recover the energy involved in its own extraction, but essentially doubles the emissions. Anyway, another newsworthy event that I'm sad to talk about is the death of Wangari Maathai, who received the Nobel Peace Prize, a prize that has from time to time been discredited by the people who receive it, but in her case it was amply warranted. Her life wove together the strands of women's empowerment and ecological restoration. And the part that I think we most need to bring home to this county, we need to bring both pieces home, because women are still far from equal in our economy. But with the climate action plan in front of us right now, our own climate action planning efforts, we need to remember the critical role of sequestration in meeting the targets. Obviously, when we did the inventory, the emissions inventory, it didn't measure solutions. It measured impacts, and transportation was huge. And we do indeed need to counter the denialists, like a certain senator from Oklahoma who says that next transportation bill needs to get back to basics, meaning, in his case, bigger highways, not safe routes to school for kids. Apparently, pavement is more basic than human life. But in addition to rethinking transportation, we need to honor and give incentives to the people who are out on our land experimenting with the best way for that land to produce not only products but ecological benefits, sequestration. We have billions of leaves throughout this county. They're not charging us a cent for what they're doing, but they are swimming upstream against the current of our fossil fuel emissions, doing every little bit that they can to stabilize the climate. And there's an evolving knowledge base on our own lands and elsewhere as people work in the direction of restoration. They need every bit of encouragement that they can, because as Wangari reminds us, it's one piece of a global effort, and we are an important part of that globe. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Mrs. Taylor, followed by Al Barrow.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. On August the 5th of 08, the county and the three Los Osos water purveyors signed an agreement to a development of a basin management plan. Whenever a Los Osos wastewater update has been presented by Public Works, the update on the basin management plan has been missing. Public Works has acknowledged that the basin plan has not been completed, and the adjudication has not been settled, meaning the ISJ. Water consumption by Sunset Terrace is accounted for by recording of the pumping of the wells at the wellhead. The scarcity of information regarding a plan for installation of meters at every residence in the S&T Water Company should be made available in an update of the basin plan, and a time certain be established for not only the installation of the water meters, but the ordering of recordation of the usage of water. I understand that the cost for meters, as well as implementing a billing procedure for the S&T Mutual Water Company, must not be charged to the assessment district. I should hope not. This is the responsibility of every resident within Sunset Terrace. This meter installation is a major component and it is necessary for the use of the recordation of the water in the basin and the basin management plan. The question of water usage and groundwater flow models is a major question in the development of a groundwater basin. With all of the delay of the ISJ, the saltwater intrusion continues and cannot wait for the implementation of the wastewater project. Saltwater intrusion, as in other areas of this county, is increasing, overdrafting of the basin is continuing, and we must stop it. Not through just words, but actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Taylor. Mr. Barrow, followed by Richard Margetson, please.
Thank you. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. I just wanted to point out to you that the State Clearinghouse number 991103 was a certified EIR for the Los Osos Wastewater Project, including the gravity collection system. One of the documents there was called Appendix B. None of your consultants can find Appendix B, which was, in fact, a liquefaction study. Well, there was a company called CFH, which was a spinoff from Fugro, one of their employees, and I spoke with the gentleman yesterday who created the document. He says it may not exist anymore. That's really rather impossible to have a certified EIR that doesn't exist anymore. So that was kind of disturbing, and I talked to the Wallace Group representative, the vice president. He's looking. He couldn't find it. Cleith Associates couldn't find it. The purpose of the liquefaction study is to mitigate earthquake damage to the infrastructure you're building. In that regard, I spoke with a sewer expert that's managed thousands of miles of gravity collection this morning. She said that an earthquake would reset the slopes. If you've ever seen an installation of a gravity sewer, you'll notice that they have to take a laser slope, that is a light that's so accurate that it follows the engineering drawings so that you can get the flow to go by gravity instead of using some other pump method or some other force. And that's supposed to save a lot of money. The problem with all of this is that if you have an earthquake, you can't mitigate it to insignificant impacts. But Bruce Gibson told us at office hours that, and John Waddell, who just spoke, told us as well that it was mitigated to insignificance. How would you do that? If this building were hit by an earthquake and it had this been built to withstand that, there wouldn't be a problem. But if it wasn't, then it would be a big problem. And the repairs for gravity sewer in an earthquake would be about the cost of installation of the sewer, because you'd have to dig it up and relay the pipe. That's $80 million. So you've got an email from last night. I sent it to the U.S. head of the USDA saying, are you going to indemnify a project? Are you going to pay for that? Where's the $80 million or whatever the cost of the repair is coming from? There is none. Mr. Gibson said that if an earthquake were to take place on site, 6.5, that would be the same as one that was, or more intense than one that was miles away, 10 miles away, that was 7.6 earthquake. That is absolutely ludicrous. We have new faults offshore that would destroy this sewer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Mr. Margetson, followed by Lindy Owen, please.
Richard Margetson. I've given you all a handout from last week's presentation on what was called the Los Osos Update. Number of us asked where the $5 million is for water conservation in this budget. After taking public comment, Mr. Gibson and Mr. Waddell skirted the issue and talked about $3.5 million as hard costs and $1.5 million will be ongoing monitoring of the program in the future, which is inconsistent with the condition of the coastal development permit. But I guess my question then would be, if the $5 million is not in the $4.3 million that I highlighted on here, where is it in this budget? And will that 1.5 be added to the $173,400,000 at the bottom of the total column to make the project $174,900,000? Because I'd like to know what other line item that $1.5 million is coming from. And on that note, of the $4.35 million per mitigation and permits unallocated, if you take $3.5 million out of that, are we assuming that $850,000 is going to cover all of the rest of the mitigation and permit factors for this project? Or is that going to be added on down the road? And the only way those can be added on, if they're not part of this budget, gentlemen, would be for those to be included in O&M. And what does that cause? That will cause the rate structure for the monthly to go up, so the monthly bills for the Los Osos Wastewater Project will go up. Because if it's not in here, the only other way you can recapture it is through O&M. My next comment deals with your kind of seemed planned attack on Mr. Brown. And I'm not a CoLab fan, but I think the analogy that was used when he asked a question about a very poorly worded line item here for interest and finance charges, which should have said interest and finance charges on interim financing for the project, you came back with an analogy about buying a home and, you know, the true cost of buying a home. Poor analogy. When you buy a home in this country and in this state, you're given a truth in lending statement within 3 days of applying for that loan. In there is your annual percentage rate, the total cost of financing, all of the interest you will pay on that loan if it's paid off over the full term, your financed charge, what you're trying to finance, and the total of payments. Total of payments. I think that's what the community is looking for at some
Thank
point.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Ms. Owen?
Good morning again, Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in Los Osos. I wanted to begin by asking, how's that investigation going on Pava Ogren and Maria Kelly and Dan Gilmore?
Ms. Owen, could you address the chair?
I'm sorry. I just glanced over that direction, so I will stare at you instead. Because I really think that we've got a serious problem. We just, I would suggest that anyone listening go to calcoastnews.com, look up the Maria and Pavo stories and see if it doesn't, I think it fails the smell test as far as it should be investigated. There were financial dealings that go up to a federal level because of that relationship and the concurrent activities that have come out of that. And so I ask our board if they would please pressure to get that study investigation done. This is the same level as Gail Wilcox and David Edge, who you took great duty upon spending outside money to have outside legal counsel come in, and they both had to step down. I also want to ask for the forensic audit. You have allowed $8 million to be spent out of our pockets. We don't know where that money's all gone. There's been money that's come and left, and there doesn't seem to be a very good accounting. We just heard different questions. Then I wanted to move on to I just wanted to mention that the state attorney is investigating the local Superior Court judges for impropriety in salaries and giving themselves huge salaries and benefit packages. Also, the nitrate monitoring testing, I've been going through some old documents, which my house is filled with. This is from, I think, the CSD, and it talks about the nitrate testing. It's the nitrate monitoring program from 2002, Cleith and Associates. It says that the purveyors, it is whoever took the project, whoever is the discharger on this sewer project, is the one who is responsible for monitoring nitrates. We haven't had the nitrate test in 6 years. Regional Board has asked for them, and why they can't be a little stronger about that, I don't know, but it is your duty to do the nitrate testing because I believe they have come down. I wanted to mention the latest, where one of the Time magazines talks about the CEO, Howard Schultz, just talking about the lack of, there's no longer a crisis of leadership, it's an emergency. Lack of cooperation and irresponsibility among elected officials today as they put partisan agendas before the people's agenda is stunning and outrageous. And then last, and I don't put that on any of you individually, but I think as a brain tank, this county has definitely not done Los Osos fair. And I heard a really funny joke in Los Osos. I just wanted to share it with you because it is good to laugh sometimes, and I think you'll find this funny. And this is about the shovel-ready status that our project had. A guy says, "My dog has created more shovel-ready projects that smell better than this one." Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. That will conclude public comment, and we will bring it back to the board And Madam Clerk, would you please introduce the first item?
Item D1. Review of proposed amendments to the county rules of procedure to implement the California Land Conservation Act of 1965.
Okay, Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, I will be stepping down on this item and the next, as I do have land with under contract within the Williamson Act in this county.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And with that, we will go over to Mr. Hogue.
Got some stuff you can take care of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can help him when you have to recuse yourself. All righty. As we watch Mr. Gibson exit, Mr. Hogue, how are you?
I am fine, Mr. Chair. How are you?
Good
morning.
Thank you.
To you and the board. We're doing Williamson Act this morning, and the first part is looking at some language of amendments that your board gave us some direction on June 7th. Terry Waller will make the presentation on this item, so I'll just turn it over to him.
Okay. Mr. Waller, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Terry Waller, planning staff. This item is a review of amendments to the rules of procedure to implement the Land Conservation Act of 1965. These amendments would focus the eligibility criteria for new contracts by raising the minimum acreage required for non-prime land. At this time, we are also requesting direction to begin the formal public hearing and adoption process. Just a few brief comments about the Williamson Act itself. The Williamson Act allows landowners and the county to place agricultural lands in contracts that allow landowners to receive reduced property taxes in exchange for commitments to maintain agricultural use of the land and thereby protect agricultural resources throughout the county. The rules of procedure set eligibility standards and include acreage limitations for conveyance of existing parcels and subdivision. The board considered the 2011 legislative platform regarding the Williamson Act subventions and related funding issues on April 5th of this year and directed staff to develop more focused criteria so the program would focus on the most productive agricultural lands. At this time, stakeholder input was also requested. Staff brought the funding issue to the Agricultural Liaison Advisory Board, ALAB, and the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee, APRC, in May of this year, and both organizations considered a list of options and made recommendations that were then brought back to the board on June 7th. At this meeting, the board considered input from ALAB and APRC and authorized processing of amendments to the rules of procedure. On July 18th, APRC considered specific revisions to the rules of procedure for dry land agricultural preserves, which would increase dry farm preserves and contract acreage requirements from the current 100-acre requirement to 160 acres for dry farm properties and 320 acres for rangeland properties. On August 1st, ALAB considered the same revisions and recommended to amend the rules as recommended by APRC. At this time, they also requested consideration of future amendments for agricultural productivity. The implications of these amendments are that fewer dry farm and rangeland properties will be eligible for ag preserves and contracts, and those properties that do qualify will be the larger and more productive ones. Thus, the scope of the program will be narrowed in future years. It should be noted that these changes will not apply to existing contracts. The recommendation is to review the final language of the proposed amendments to the county rules of procedure as shown in the attachment one of the staff report and direct that the formal public hearing and adoption process be started. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Terry. Questions of Mr. Waller before we open? Not at this point. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you. Not relative to this specific presentation, but going forward, we're setting a hearing before the Board of Supervisors for this item. Will that strictly be before the or solely be before the Board of Supervisors, or will there be other outreach efforts, or has that already occurred?
We're going directly to the Board of Supervisors with the advertised public hearing because we've already satisfied the requirements for other reviewing bodies.
So your outreach to the advisory bodies and so
exactly.
forth.
We've been there several times.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I just wanted to make that clear to the listening public that it would be coming back to us only, not going out to the various committees again.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Hogue, did you want to, I saw you leaning
forward. I just wanted to add that the process of amending the rules of procedure is governed by the Williamson Act, and it has a somewhat different process than what we're used to for most land use planning things where it goes through other bodies. The Williamson Act specifies mainly at your board. At our option, we do go to the local advisory groups, and we have done that.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogue. Okay, let me open it up. We have a couple of requests to speak. Chuck Pritchard, followed by Joy Fitzhugh, please. Morning, Mr. Pritchard. Always good to see you.
Good morning, Supervisor Hill, gentlemen. Chuck Pritchard. Going to wear two hats. I left them both on the chair, so it's okay.
Okay.
Comment as far as the Williamson Act is concerned. I sent around a document. It's called the Green Page from the County Assessor's Office. Anyone that has a Williamson Act contract gets one of these on a yearly basis. And we fill that out and submit it back to the County Assessor. And that basically indicates to the San Luis Obispo County what the values are on real estate under the Williamson Act. How many head of cattle, how many acres we farm, if there's vines, if there are trees, whatever. Now, our operation is in San Luis and Kern County, contiguous. So I get a green sheet, and from Kern County, I get a pink sheet. So I get to fill out two of these on a yearly basis so you folks know basically what we're doing on that land. And anyone under a Williamson Act contract gets one of these. So that's for your information. If you're not a contract holder, you've probably never seen one of these. So that's how the county knows what we're doing under the Williamson Act, what the land is producing, basically, and that goes and helps them as far as a fair tax evaluation on productive value. And I think that's the key with the Williamson Act, is basically it's taxed on the productive value of the land. And as far as agriculture is concerned, I think that's what we're asking for, and that is basically the continuation of the project, the Williamson Act, as it is right now, because that's what it does. It evaluates the productive value as opposed to speculative value on sales. I think that's real critical for agriculture. So I would just recommend that you give that consideration when you look at this Williamson Act going forward from here. Also, I've sent to you a copy of this. It's a workshop that's being put on Wednesday, October 12th, out at the Bonheim Ranch. And it's on resources, but it also gives you a chance to go on a working ranch, a landscape, and look at what is being done and how it's being operated. And this would also give you a little bit more insight as far as the productive value of agricultural land, because it incorporates agriculture. It also, in this particular case, incorporates a hunting and a wildlife enterprise as well. So it's a combination of about three different enterprises. And that would also be shown on that green sheet as well. So it's a really nice combination of the Williamson Act being up for your reevaluation and this workshop coming at an appropriate time. So I'd recommend that as many of you folks could make it. Also recommend, Terry, folks from the Planning Department.
Thank you.
Try to be there. And also some of our friends down at the Regional Water Quality Control Board. I'm sure this is going out over television and maybe radio as well. I would recommend that they try to attend as well to get a full first-hand look as to what's actually happening on the ground.
Right.
Thank you very much.
If you could hold on just a second, Mr. Pritchard, I got a question for you, and I really do appreciate you being here both to point out the important distinctions on the Williamson Act and also to promote this good event. And since we all have a copy of it, if people are listening and they want to find out more about this this management workshop tour, please call our offices and we'll get that information to them. But Mr. Patterson has a question for you.
Yes, and I do know that this went out to all subscribers to the Cooperative Extension list, so I got it a few days ago. Mr. Pritchard, just one quick question. Are you supportive of the recommended changes that's before us today?
Yeah, I'm an alternate on the Williamson Act Subcommittee and also a member of the Ag Liaison Committee representing the Resource Conservation Districts. And, yeah, we supported those changes, those increases in acreages, yes.
Very good.
Those are the two that we did support.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Ms. Fitzhugh, good morning.
Good morning. Joy Fitzhugh, San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau. And as regards to the amendments, and you've heard this before, but I want you to seriously think about it. It's not necessarily the increase in the size of the land. It's staying in production. And I know that this was a request. I brought it up at Ag Liaison, and they agreed that this needs to be a major part, this remaining in production, far more important than saying that 320 acres of grazing land is more productive than 100 acres. I can tell you from personal experience as a rancher, for most of us, 320 isn't going to make us any more profit or any less loss than 100 acres. And so we may be biting something on the wrong side here when we say let's increase this minimum parcel size for criteria. The point being, it needs to be in ag production. That's what the Williamson Act is all about. And I do echo what Chuck said about the green sheet. I fill one out each year. Even if you rent the land for grazing or production, you have to put that on the sheet too. So it's a very comprehensive criteria for what you do on your land to determine the value and the productivity of that land. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy. Daniel Sinton, please. Morning.
Good morning. Daniel Sinton. I'm a rancher here in San Francisco County. I just was going to give you guys an update on the program that we had talked about earlier for Cal Poly doing the economic impact of agriculture on and the Williamson Act on San Luis Obispo County. They're in progress right now. They have funding, and they should be completing it hopefully soon. I believe she's probably watching this right now. So as soon as we have that, we'll be able to bring that back to you.
Great. Thank you. Quick question, Mr. Sinton, from Supervisor Patterson.
Yes. Mr. Sinton, you had talked about this study last time this issue was before us. And is it just taking a look at the Williamson Act contracts, or is it looking at all agricultural production?
That's a good question. It's I have an overview of the project right here. I believe it is mostly the impact of the impact of both agriculture and the Williamson Act on the county and it and how the economic impact of it. Okay. So I believe it's for both.
Okay, very good. So we will be able to actually differentiate between the total and the Williamson Act contracted properties.
Right. I mean, the goal of the project is to explain that agriculture is a net revenue positive to the county, whereas residential, commercial, and industrial are a net negative despite the taxes that those groups pay.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sinton, one more question from Supervisor
Richard. One more time, Daniel. Thank you, and I do really appreciate you doing this. I think you just clarified it. This study is more across the board from an agricultural standpoint, not specific to Williamson Act.
Correct. Yeah. It's there to prove essentially that the Williamson Act provides a benefit to keeping agriculture in agriculture and thus revenue to the county as.
And I would assume that you've been in touch with the Ag Commissioner's office. As I talked to Marty about this, and he said that they were going to be trying to help any way they can to provide whatever data you needed as well.
Right. I need to speak to Marty.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sinton. I think we all look forward to seeing that study as soon as it's.
Yeah, as soon as they're done.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for being here. And I saw Ms. Lacey rush in. I didn't know if you wanted to speak on this item or the next. Okay. Any further on that? Mr. Pritchard, do you want to speak again on this item? You have to come to the microphone if need be. I'm sorry to yank you back up here, but.
No, I neglected something. I just wanted to introduce you folks to our new executive director from the Upper Salinas Los Establish Resource Conservation Districts, and her name is Laura Edwards. And she came on board on about the 15th of September, and so we're glad to have her on board, doing a good job.
Great. Welcome, Ms. Edwards. Good to have you. Okay, that will close public comment on this item, and I will bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham?
Well, I think we all received the information from the Ag Liaison. The other one's lost me. The Ag Preserve Review Committee, and right. Both have supported this. I've talked to some of the ag interests that also are in support of, so I will move for staff's recommendation.
Second.
Okay, moved by Supervisor Meacham, second by Supervisor Teixeira. Supervisor Patterson, did you have a final comment before we go?
Yes, I certainly support the motion, but also having participated in conversations with our Ag Liaison Advisory Board and other ag groups, after the vote, I would like the opportunity to direct staff to move forward with having conversations with the ag community about keeping Williamson Act land in agriculture. In talking with staff, and note that it is in our staff report that issue has come forward, has been discussed. It was felt that it was better to go ahead and complete this Williamson Act rules of procedure issue because it was somewhat simple, whereas the other one is not. But I don't want to lose the opportunity to move that conversation forward. So I'll be recommending after the vote that we direct staff to initiate that effort as well.
Is that understood, Mr. Hoag? I mean, it doesn't need to be a separate.
Whatever your board wishes to do, but I'll just say simply, we were going to do it anyway.
There you go.
We listened to ALAB, heard them loud and clear. We discussed their idea with Ag Preserve Review Committee, and the Review Committee is ready to tackle this issue after the first of the year.
Good.
So we consider that part two, and this is part one.
Very good.
Thank you, Supervisor Patterson. With that, roll call, Madam Clerk, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson? Oh,
he's
sorry.
Accused.
Mr. Patterson and
yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes, thank you. And if you could introduce the next item, Madam Clerk, I'd appreciate it. And here's Ms. Brown taking over for Mr. Waller.
I can. Yeah.
Item E1, discussion regarding the possible implementation of Assembly Bill 1265 for alternative Williamson Act funding.
Okay. I see Ms. Brown getting into place. So we'll give her a second, and then we will turn it over to her. And are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. I'm Leslie Brown from the Administrative Office. And we're here today. This is a follow-up to the item that Warren Hoag presented to you on June 7th when we went over some legislation for alternative funding for the Williamson Act. So this is a follow-up because the legislation that was pending at that time has now been passed. So we wanted to walk you through that. That's AB 1265. And per board direction, we have spoken to the two main stakeholder committees, and we'll provide a summary of that. And then the purpose is really to ask your board if you would like us to proceed with the next steps in considering implementation of AB 1265. A hearing would need to be set. Notices would need to be sent out ahead of time. And there's additional board direction that we're seeking. So that's the purpose of our presentation. Excuse me. So just a little background on the Williamson Act. This law was passed in 1965, and the purpose is to preserve ag and open space lands. And how it works is that landowners contract with cities and counties to keep their land, to voluntarily restrict the use of their land to agriculture and open space uses. And in exchange for that, since Prop 13 was passed, properties receive a lower of three values. The value based on actual use or productive use, which we call the Williamson Act calculation, The factor base year or the Prop 13 base year, whichever is lower of those two, or the current market value. And each of these contracts are what we call a rolling 10 to 20-year contract, which means that at the end of each year, another year is added on to the term, and they continue on in perpetuity. So currently we have about 3,600 parcels that are under contract, under 1,100 contracts. The total property tax, foregone property tax, for all government agencies in our county that receive property tax is about $10.5 million from these properties. And the actual foregone property tax loss to the county itself is about $3 million. Beginning in fiscal year 1972-73 through 2008-09, the state was paying counties subventions to help offset a portion of that property tax loss. And up until 2008-09, we received about $1.1 million each year. And then in 2008-09, the state reduced the subvention amount by about 10%. And then eliminated it entirely in 2009-10. So for the last 3 years, we have lost about $3.1 million in direct subvention payments and have absorbed that in our budget. So to go through AB 1265, this law was enacted mid-July, and basically what it does is restores the provisions of the repealed Senate Bill 863, which is the law that we described in the June 7th presentation. Essentially what this bill does is allows the county to reduce the term of these contracts by 1 year, which has the effect of increasing the assessed value that the landowner will pay taxes on. And the intent of the bill is to help the county offset some of the loss of the state subvention. Some people are calling this a self-help bill. County participation in this bill is voluntary, and it will sunset in January 2016, so it's essentially 4 years. It's available to us whenever the state subvention payment is half of the foregone property tax revenue. So as you may recall, our property tax revenue that we were giving up was $3 million, and so our subvention's always been less than that half mark. If for some reason the state subvention payment was more than that, then the implementation would be suspended in the following year. So for contracts that have a 10-year term, there would be 1 year reduction, and for contracts with a 20-year term, there would be 2 year reductions. And the way AB 1265 works is that because of the term reduction, there's a 10% benefit reduction to the landowner on the difference between the unrestricted value of the property or the Prop 13 base year or the market value of the property. I don't know if that was clear enough, but so basically for every dollar in property tax that the contract landowner currently avoids by having their land in under contract, AB 1265 would require that about 10 cents be paid to the county each year. Landowners have the option to opt out of this and not have their term reduced and thus be pay the 10% or pay on the 10% increase in their assessment value by serving a non-renewal notice, and that starts the cancellation process. Excuse me. There are some noticing requirements in this bill. If your board decides to hold a hearing to consider implementation of this bill, we would need to send out notices to all landowners in a timely manner. We're interpreting that to mean either between 10 days or 2 weeks prior to the hearing. Once the hearing is held and the board decides to implement Assembly Bill 1265, we would send out notices again notifying landowners of that decision, or in subsequent years, if your board decides to rescind that decision, we would send out notices on that. We will also notify landowners, probably in that same notice, that they have the option to prevent this reduction in their contract term by serving the notice of non-renewal. And per the law, they have 90 days to do that. However, given the timing of the passage of this bill, there's a provision in there that the board can modify the rules of procedure so that the landowners can file this notice within 60 days and no later than February 1st of 2012. We also need to record a listing of all affected properties and the landowners' names, or alternatively, all of the properties that are not affected and the landowners' names. And then for each landowner who has voluntarily or who has decided not to opt out, will receive on their tax bill a separate line item that shows the increased tax amount that they'll be paying as a result of implementation of this legislation. This program does not apply to contracts that have not been renewed, contracts with cities, open space and ag easements, scenic restrictions and wildlife habitat contracts. It also, at the board's discretion, may or may not apply to atypical term contracts. And as you may know, almost all of our contracts are considered atypical term, which means that they start with a 20-year term, they decline to 10 years, and then move into that rolling 10-year period. So if the board were to determine that these atypical contracts would be included in AB 1265 provisions, they would need to determine that applying these provisions would not be inequitable to these contract holders, and that implementation of 1265 would not be administratively infeasible. This is specific language in the law. And our staff is recommending that your board make those determinations, that it is administratively feasible to implement 1265 for these contracts. We've already done an estimate of the amount that each contract holder would pay. Because almost all of our contracts are these atypical terms, it would be equitable. The landowners would be all treated in an equal manner. And since most of our contracts are this type, if we were to exclude them, we would be foregoing, foregoing the benefits of this program. So I have a couple of examples here that I actually received from the assessor's office. I rounded up the numbers just to make it easy. This is an example of a property that was purchased in 1975. The base year would be probably a lot lower than more recently purchased properties, $324,000. The restricted value, or Williamson Act value, on this property is $131,000. So you see the difference is $193,000. So the 10% difference as a result of reducing the contract term is $19,300. And the landowner would pay 1% tax on that 10%, which is $193 per year. Now, this is an example of a more recently purchased property with a full unrestricted value of $7.3 million. The Williamson Act value, or restrictive value, is $3.7 million with a difference of $3.6 million. So the 10% difference on this is $360,000, and the 1% tax paid on this difference would be $3,600 a year. A summary of the financial considerations. In terms of the county benefits, we've estimated by running an estimate of all the current contracts that we have, we estimate that we would receive about $1 million a year, which is comparable to our state subvention amount, or $4 million over the 4 years if we implemented each of the 4 years. And that's assuming that none of the contract holders were to serve notices of non-renewal. We also did an assessment of what the hard costs would be to implement this. We're assuming that labor costs would be absorbed, that we would not be adding any staff to implement this. There are some one-time computer programming costs that the assessor would need in order to run the list of contracts and the additional assessment for the auditor. And that's just a one-time. And then the notices that would need to be mailed out each year would cost about $4,900 each year. So just a summary, based on the analysis that we've done so far with the contract holders that we would see a benefit reduction for, the range is really wide, from as little as $1 a year to up to $21,000 a year. 74% of these contract holders would need to pay at less than $1,000 a year. Almost 87% of all of the contract holders would pay less than $2,000 a year. And we did an average, which doesn't say much because the range was so wide, but it's approximately $960 a year, and the median was $450 a year. So this indicates to us that the annual impact to the landowners would not be hugely significant. I mean, it's based on their individual circumstances, but I just wanted to give you a sense of what that would look like. And of course, if they were to file a notice of non-renewal, the impacts to them would be much greater. So as I mentioned, staff did go meet with the Ag Liaison Advisory Committee and with the Agricultural Review our Preserve Review Committee. An overview of this law was presented to them, and both committees recommend that the board not implement AB 1265, mostly because of the impact on existing contract holders. And Warren Hogue is here if you have more specific questions about those meetings. I was not at those meetings.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brown. I had one. Actually, let me have I have a couple questions here from my colleague, Supervisor Patterson, followed by Supervisor Meacham.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brown, it's my understanding, as you had mentioned, this bill sunsets January 1st, 2016, so it's got a 4-year operational period. Can a respective county enter or exit that program at any time during those 4 years?
Yes, your board can have a hearing each year, and as my understanding, the eight counties that implemented Senate Bill 863, that was the process that they intended to proceed with as well. So each year you can determine whether you want to continue or not.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Two questions. Leslie, the sunset issue, what does that mean when at the end of the time period and this sunsets, does everything go back to the way it was?
Yes, or a county could decide to either not proceed with the program or to stop accepting additional contracts, et cetera. Okay. It was designed as a temporary solution to address the loss of the state subvention.
The second question is more to the examples that you gave as far as what different folks would pay. And you went from $1 to $21,000. Can you give me an example of the $21,000? What type of a property would that apply to?
I might ask Kurt Kidwell to come up and answer that, if you don't mind, Kurt. The assessor's office actually did the assessment and looked at each of the contracts to determine how much they would pay and might have a better sense of what type of property that would be.
And the percentages of that high amount. You gave like 85% would be this. If you go back to that first couple of slides back, right here. 74%, 87%. What percentage of those would be to 21,000?
Well, I know offhand it would be extremely small. There were not very many contracts that were in that high range, but I don't have that information with me right now. We would have to get that to you.
Okay. And then one other thing that after we hear public comment, but I want to throw out something to think about as folks come up, because I think that it's important to recognize that the state of California, we've determined that agriculture is our number one industry, and the same thing with San Luis Obispo County. So if we're actually going to suggest that or promote that, then I think we need to find ways that we incentivize some of our ag folks to stay in business. So a question, and I talked to Mr. Buckshy about this yesterday, would there be a way, if we decided to go the route of implementation, to incrementally do this over time? We're going through a seven-year pain plan in terms of our county budgets and everything else, and I was wondering if there would be an opportunity to be able to incrementally get through this as we get through our pain plan program as well.
Well, it's our reading of the legislation that you implement it with the 10% increase on the assessed value. There was no scaling provision included in the legislation.
But it seems to me that if this is voluntary, then we would have the ability to craft this however we'd want, I would assume, or not.
We've taken a look at that. We believe you would be limited to the specific program that's set up here. You would need additional legislation to have something incremental.
Mr. Grant?
Yes, I just would remind the board that this is a four-year program with a sunset, but each year you could take a look at it, and if the budget conditions were better than we thought, you could stop the process and turn it back. So you would, on a year-to-year basis, you would have to could make that decision.
But I guess it kind of goes back to the whatever's going to be required from the assessor's office and the what's involved in all of that. I don't know if that's going to be kind of a significant effort to try to put this in place and then each year make adjustments. I don't know what's involved in all of that.
Mr. Kidwell, are you ready to entertain a couple of questions? I know we're putting you on the spot, but.
Okay. Kirk Kidwell, County Assessor's Office. So Leslie, first to answer the question that Leslie asked me to come up here. On the one for $21,000, we did not look at each of the individual parcels to see what the operation was for the $1 or the $21,000. But I can surmise that the ones with the lower values are properties that have been held in the Williamson Act for quite some time. The ones that are at the higher end are ones that have recently been acquired with the market values at their height. I would also suspect that $21,000 one that we're talking about could very well be like a vineyard or something like that that's just been developed. You also have, during that time period, when vines are first being put in, they don't come on to, they're not part of the calculation right off the bat because they do have some growing period before they become productive. And so you would see a large difference. So I would suspect that's probably what you're looking at.
Well, I guess I was looking at more, Kurt, if you have a possible percentage, as we suggest here, 74% would pay $1,000 or less, 87% would $2,000 or less. Is there a percentage, roughly, of the $21,000 the higher end of this?
How many people would be?
You're talking about 1%, 2%?
The remainder would be, what, about 16% above 2,000, assuming?
13%.
I actually have another figure for you. 92% of the landowners would pay less than 3,000. So we're talking a very small percentage of landowners that would be in that large number.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Kidwell, the other question the Supervisor Meacham had, a good question, was if we were to implement, you know, depending on, since we have this sunset and we probably, knowing how the state is operating, probably will let the program continue beyond even the four-year plan. Does that create havoc, I guess, in your office in some ways, as to if the board were to go year to year on deciding whether, depending on our budget situation, as Mr. Grant points out?
Well, I can break it down in two areas. The area of preparing to be able to make the calculations and delivering those figures to the auditor is relatively small. There's some programming effort both on to deliver the information to the auditor, and also we would take steps to inform each person in the contract using our assessment notices to give them information about what that calculated amount's going to be, or that they will be receiving that calculated amount. The part that we are uncertain about and we anticipate can be impacted quite a bit would be in two areas, the assessment appeals area. They still have the ability to appeal their assessed value, and we don't know the impact, but we anticipate that we could see more assessment appeals because whatever difference they might receive there, it would impact that calculation amount. And then the second one would be just inquiries alone. There's 1,100 people. They're going to be looking, since this calculation is going to be based on that difference, they're going to be watching those assessments and watching the calculated amount fairly closely. Right. And so we anticipate that we'd be having discussions with all those people, making sure that they want to make sure that we did it correctly.
Okay. Mr. Grant, please.
Yes, just another comment in terms of going in and out of the program. It would be my recommendation that if the board were to adopt this program to give us the extra $1 million a year, we're still in our seven-year pain plan. We don't think we're going to be out of it for 3 or 4 years, so I don't see us recommending moving out of this until we're at such a point where we're healthy enough to be able to afford to back out of it. That may be the four-year sunset at that point. So my guess is the recommendation from my office would be to continue the program for at least 2 or 3 years until we get our finances in order again to where we could afford to back out of the program.
Okay.
May I make one additional comment?
Please.
Just a comment that Leslie brought forward, and it came about during the initial implementing of the language, but the changing of the 10-year and 20-year contracts down to 18 or 9 is not going to reduce the assessed calculations by 10%. It's not a... the only thing that allows contract owners is if they do opt out, they're opting out at a shorter period of time. They can get out in 9 years as opposed to 10 or whatever that is. It will not... The calculated amount on the productive use would remain the same. The same calculation would remain the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kidwell. Appreciate
I have
it.
A question.
Actually, we do have one more question for you, if you could. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, Mr. Kidwell, just to follow up on the suggested implementation costs that Ms. Brown submitted, there was a one-time cost of $6,000 plus an ongoing or annual cost of $5,000. You mentioned that one thing that you couldn't really predict is what the increased appeal activity would be, which would mostly require staff time, I presume,
yes,
to address. That's not included in that initial startup of $11,000.
No.
That would be an addition.
Yes.
And would be staff time, basically.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay,
I see no more questions. Mr. Kidwell, thank you.
Right.
Appreciate it. I did have one thing that I wanted to ask of Ms. Brown, I think, or Mr. Grant. So if you look at what you pointed out, which was essentially the property tax loss from this subsidy is about $10.5 million a year for the county. And, of course, as we know from our formula, so we get – that's about a $3 million loss. So probably the lion's share of the loss is to the school districts, which get about 60% of our property tax dollar, and then cities and CSDs get the other portion outside of the county. So I guess the question would be, have we or could we, ask these other agencies that are property tax recipients what they think about such a program? Because, in fact, probably – well, not probably, definitely the school school loss is greater than even the county property tax loss, and maybe Mr. Jensen will.
Mr. Chairman, I believe all of the money from implementation goes to the county, and it would have no impact whatsoever on the other tax-receiving entities.
Okay, excellent. Good. That was easy enough. Well, all right.
Their loss would be the same.
Yeah, yeah. Their loss is the same. All right. Let's go to public comment, if we could, and if you want to speak, please bring up your slips. I'll begin with Joy Fitzhugh, followed by Steve Sinton, please. Morning again.
Good morning again. Joy Fitzhugh, Sounds Obispo County Farm Bureau, and I want to thoroughly support what Ag Liaison and the Rules of Procedure Committee said is not to implement this. I think aside from the financial impact to the agricultural community, there is a psychological impact. And it was brought up at Ag Liaison. I don't remember who brought it up, but I think it's very valid. Yes, this may have a sunset in 4 years, but you can believe once the state has decided that the counties can be made to pick up that extra dime or thousands of dimes from the ag community, they're going to put legislation in that will make this permanent. And next thing you know, it's just going to be a creeping until pretty soon you have your land locked in under a contract, but the cost continues to rise. And the whole point is agriculture needs to be valued at its use. And this is just creeping back up to a value that is far greater than its productivity. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy. Mr. Sinton, followed by Mike Brown, please.
Thank you. I'm Steve Sinton from Shandon. I was on the committee at the Cattlemen's that reviewed this legislation, and the thought there was, this law is better than losing the Williamson Act, and that was kind of the reason why Cattlemen's voted in favor of it. But if it's not really an issue whether this county is going to abandon the Williamson Act, then perhaps this is not something that we need to do or should do. The numbers I saw up on the board didn't look that bad except for a few people. But if you go back to the thing that Daniel was talking about, does ag really cost the county or does it pay? By keeping land in agriculture, are we actually doing better financially than we would if it went out? Then you have to ask yourself, if we enact this, do we lose anybody from our Williamson Act contract? Do we get a non-renewal? In which case, I think long-term, the county is a loser in this process. And so I would urge you also to not implement this. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Sinton. Mr. Brown, followed by Dee Lacey, please.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. We're opposed to the implementation of this, and we agree with your various agriculture advisory committees that this is a very slippery slope. You know, this occurred because the state of California is broke, and the state of California is largely broke because of its financial policies and its regulatory environment, which has negatively affected the economy. So here we are talking about beginning to erode the best land conservation and environmental legislation in the state. The most effective, it's voluntary, it doesn't require huge administrative costs, and it's actually the farmers and ranchers who are the stewards of the land. And unlike conservation groups and things that take the property totally off the tax rolls, it stays on the tax rolls under the Williamson Act. In this county, and as your own ag department has pointed out, ag is a $700 million a year direct sales industry, but if you factor in all the tributary things like trucking and seeds and fertilizer and farm implements and so on, it's worth billions. Finally, you had this year, I think after the books closed and you netted it out, The departments did a good job and under-expended $6.2 million in the general fund, of which $4.3 million, as I recall, were placed in reserves. So you don't actually need to do this. And as we have said before, one alternative would be to divert some of the money that's being spent on plans and regulations from the general fund to the tune of $6 million in planning to something really beneficial like this, and at the same time stop adding more regulations and rules. Thank you very much, and if you have any questions, I'm available.
Ms. Lacey, followed by Chuck Pritchard, please.
Hi, Dee Lacey, Chairman of Ag Liaison Advisory Committee. I won't repeat what you've already heard. I support Steve's position and Daniel's and Joy's, Mr. Brown. I first, though, would want to say on behalf of ALAB, we want to thank the staff from planning. Warren, as you know, is the expert, the history, on the Williamson Act. He always takes time to come and be with us, and ALAB meets at night, so it's after a long day. We tend in agriculture groups to rehash things that we've talked for a long time because we're always thinking about the what if, and he's always there for it, and we are very sad that we're going to lose his expertise, and I want to thank him for all the time he's given us over the years. The staff and also the assessor staff came out one of the nights to help us, and you all saw some of the calculations they were doing. We understand the economic challenges that you are facing as a county, and in fact that was a big part of the discussion at ALAB, is the position that you've been in. On the other hand, they also say that talking to you about saving the Williamson is like singing to the choir, that you have been, as a Board of Supervisors, very supportive of agriculture in this county. We know you understand the economic vitality to this county comes from agriculture. In the recent task force that you put together, Supervisor Hill and Meacham, who co-chaired it, certainly saw that that was a big part of it. We'd love to add all that information about that circulating dollar that comes out of agriculture and what it brings to this county. But so we're saying the value of keeping producers on the land and giving them this tool and not asking them to help defray the cost is where ALAB came down. We were in the same position as the cattlemen. If that meant losing it, we certainly would look at whatever adjustments that you would offer up. But our position is we would hope that you wouldn't enact this and that you would support us as you have in the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Dee. And Mr. Pritchard.
Board, Chuck Pritchard again. A couple of comments and then a couple of personal anecdotes. I think it's around 25 to 27% of the land in the county of San Luis Obispo is in public ownership, somewhere around that. Over 50% of the state of California is in public ownership, and 65% of the western United States are in public ownership. Okay? So when we're looking at a diminishing resource as far as private ownership of land, it keeps getting smaller, and yet we keep asking more and more in the way of property taxes. You got the same argument, I know, on the national level with the income tax structure. Some point in time, gentlemen, we have to get serious and say, what are we going to fund, what is necessary, and how are we going to do it? And we're going to have to start holding the various agencies, committees, subcommittees, whatever, accountable to do their job. And if they don't, they're going to have to go away. Now, that's the down and dirty truth. And we're not there yet, I understand. But at some point in time, we can't keep putting the onus on the taxpayers to do more and more with less and less. It just doesn't happen. We had a piece of property on our ranch. Person died 35 years ago. No heirs. We had to go to court and do a quiet title to get ownership. on that one 360 acres in the middle of our operation, even though we had paid taxes on it all this time, so it didn't go delinquent. That also triggered a reassessment. Okay? We have three parcels right now on a neighbor's property, and they have a couple on ours. We would like to make a trade. It's adjacent property. It's not 5 miles apart. It's within a half a mile of each other on the same side of a hill. We would like to do that simply to clear the title and the ease of operation. If we do that, that's also going to trigger a reassessment at today's market values. We now have a couple of sun power or photovoltaic power companies buying real estate on the Carrizo Plains because of endangered species mitigation, which from my perspective as being a landowner out there and looking at almost 600,000 to 700,000 acres already under conservation easement or public ownership in that same area, I thought it was basically extortion. I thought it was ridiculous. But it's happening. And they're paying, I've heard, as much as $2,000 an acre. So what's that going to do to our land values and our tax bases? Where's that land going to end up? Is it going to end up in public ownership again? I mean, the comment was, well, we want to keep it in the private side. After the conservation easement that I've looked at that's going to be placed on that land, no one's going to want to buy that stuff because you can't do a thing with it. So it's a bigger issue than just this. And again, I agree with all the comments made by my predecessors. I think that it's critical not to go down this road. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Appreciate it. And that will close it to public comment, all good comments. I would like to point out to those listening at home, too, before the board gets into its discussions, that what this legislation does, because I don't know that everybody's clear from the state, is it literally and figuratively passes the buck to the counties, you know, rather than continuing to do what it should be doing, which it has done, which is funding the subvention for the Williamson Act. It says, well, okay, we're not going to do that, but we'll let the counties tax essentially or add the fee to the folks in the property. And I, you know, it's I do think, as has been pointed out, it's another another problem that the state has pushed off on local folks, and it's not not one that I'm particularly happy about. But with that, I will turn it to my colleagues, and we'll see where we go. Mr. Patterson, followed by Mr. Meacham.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate people coming in and giving us their opinions and information on this item. I was able to attend a couple of Ag Liaison Advisory Board meetings where this subject was discussed. It actually goes back several months where it first came up with other legislation, but the essence is the same. I'm not ready to support implementation of this bill at this time. I think for the reasons stated by many of the presenters, basically what it does is it passes what subvention money we would get to the contractees. They would actually be paying more in that money that we've been backfilling than and previously the state has been backfilling prior to 3 years ago, I believe, when they stopped giving us the subvention. That would go to the property owners. And yes, we're in a 7-year pain plan, but it has been getting better for our county. Our budget gaps are decreasing every year, and hopefully will continue to decrease, and we'll know in another month or two what that looks like for next fiscal year when we start our budgeting for 12-13. We have the opportunity, as was pointed out, to implement this at any time over the next 4 years. If we see that need. I just don't think we see the need right now. The Williamson Act is the most successful conservation tool that we currently have in this county. We've got a number of different conservation options out there being used effectively, but this is the one where we get the greatest participation, and I think certainly we should support it as much as we can, as we have been. So I wouldn't support implementation at this time. I would recommend that we revisit it every year. And granted, if we don't implement it now, we're not going to receive revenue for 12-13. So We would have to backfill the state subvention that we won't get. We can be sure of that again, but we've done that for the last 3 years, and I've been comfortable doing that, and I think we can afford to do it again. We have this tool available to us. If we want to use it in the future, I don't think we need to use it now.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I'm not ready to implement this, and there's a couple of things here that I think really bears waiting out, and one in particular, as Mr. Sinton mentioned, we really have no economic analysis of what that multiplier effect of agriculture is. We don't know what taking something out of agricultural production is going to equate in implementing something like this. So I think until we have that kind of information to really give us a good assessment of everything, and the other part of it is, as was mentioned, we did do this economic strategy for the county. And one of the big, big drivers of this county is agriculture. And so until we have any type of analysis that would indicate to me that it's much more beneficial from an economic standpoint to take it out, I'm not going to support implementation of this at this point.
Very good. Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. And I support the thoughts of my colleagues, and I'd also like to thank everybody for being here today. A couple of things, though. Ms. Fitzhugh and Mr. Pritchard brought to my attention about the fact that we are not only keeping this land in production, but we're keeping it open. And it's passed on from generation to generation. And what I would like to see is to, when and if we do implement this law, to look at that money and put it into education and put it in to maybe the Visitors and Tourism Bureau to replenish and or make those better. I mean, we're keeping the land in ag, but we need to keep that next generation of farmer in ag. How many times do we see the kids that we're raising today don't go back to the family farm because it's not productive, or they can't afford to pay the taxes, or mom and dad have sold it because they couldn't afford to keep it? And I think if we are going to implement it, which someday down the road I would see it happening, that we take that money and invest it in the education of our young people to make them better farmers, more productive farmers, green farmers, whatever you want to do. But that would be my stand. Thank you.
Okay, and I will just add my own agreement, which makes it unanimous for those of us here. And I want to. I thought that there were very good comments made by our friends who came to help us today. I think both the senior Mr. Sinton and the junior Mr. Sinton, both very helpful about the value of ag and its importance to our county, to our state, to the nation. And it is we do look forward to the Cal Poly report so that we can have some real information to be able to utilize while making decisions. I think that's critical, and I'm not prepared to add any further burdens to our agriculturalists at this time, that's for sure, and especially because this is, as I pointed out, something where the state is telling us, well, we're not going to do it, but we'll let you do it, and you'll do it by our rules, and that gets back to Mr. Pritchard's, I thought, very good comments about prioritizing. You know, I think that at the local level, we've done a good job of prioritizing and saying, you know, this is what we're going to spend money on, this is what we're going to cut, this is, you know, we're not seeing that at the state and the federal level, unfortunately. We're seeing a lack of prioritizing. We're seeing too much, you know, of basically one, you know, each side just saying, this is all we care about, this is all we care about, but they're not really prioritizing what matters. I think to get to finally to Ms. Lacey's point, this board has and will continue to be robust supporters of the Williamson Act. It's a critical part of what we do in our county. It's a critical part not just for the obvious production of food and fiber, but the quality of life that is so important to the people that live here, to the people that visit here. I can't imagine any time that we will not continue to support the Williamson Act. We've had some of the toughest budget years ahead, but happily, and this is my way of making our admin folks feel better because, you know, they always have to do less with less or more with less, but we have done a very good job of managing our finances in this county, and because we've done such a good job of managing our finances in this county, we are able to make priority decisions. This, to my mind, is an incredibly important decision, continuing to fund the Williamson Act and not asking more from the folks who are utilizing the land to serve us all. So with that, I'll go to Mr. Meacham for a motion.
Thank you. And before I go there, I want to thank the junior Mr. Sinton, the senior Mr. Sinton, and the senior Mr. Sinton that helped write the Williamson Act back in 1946-47. With that, I'm going to make a motion that we do not implement AB 1265 at this time.
Yeah, and I'll second that motion.
And comment, Mr. Beck?
Yeah, I do. And in fairness and balance, I do want to say that not all counties, not all rural counties in the state of California are as well off as we are. And as Mr. Sinton pointed out, and others have too, there are agriculturists that feel that they need, their counties need to implement this. It was legislation that was adopted at the state legislature with bipartisan support, and in some places they need it to keep the counties from going bankrupt, basically, and I don't want to lose that as part of the conversation. It's a bigger picture than just San Luis Obispo County, and we're fortunate that we have the opportunity to make the decision not to implement this. Other counties aren't in that position, and that really didn't get conveyed. And I think it's important that people do know that not all counties in California are as fortunate as San Luis Obispo County. And there are some of those very rural counties that are on the brink of bankruptcy, and they felt that they needed something like this to keep them afloat, and I just wanted to put that message out there too.
Well, before we go to the roll call, perhaps our CAO wants to brag about our county. I hope, and his fine and his and his fine stewardship of our finances.
I think we've done a good job. The board has provided great guidance.
I think your mic's on, Jim.
Your board has provided great policy guidance over the last couple of years, and we've been able to make some of the tough decisions, but it's still going to be a delicate balance, and I want to warn the board that it's a delicate balance to provide the services that you want with our declining revenues. We still will have a gap next year.
Right.
This was one opportunity to provide some revenue for it, and certainly we're going to work within the board decision to make the best budget that we can, but I need you to know that we have some things coming up that will be a challenge to fund, and one's a Creston Fire Station that will be finished next year that will, I'm sure board members will want to staff it. Not sure how we're going to do that at this point in time. We have libraries out there that we purchased that are going to need some staffing that I'm not sure how we're going to do that. So even though we have done, I believe, a very good job in balancing the budget, and we will continue to do so, the point is there are going to be some hard decisions down the road still. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be easy next year or the next year or the next year.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, and one of the things that everybody, that not obviously not just here, but who listen and pay attention, is that I think that we could use more input, helpful input, because I do think in the community we have been able to, for the most part, escape some of the kind of ideological gridlock at the state and the federal levels, and so as a community we can help to get input on our priorities. Obviously, this is a priority that so many of us agree on already, and as we have challenges ahead, it's not as if we have the ability, as Mr. Grant says, to just be able to spend on everything. It's good to have a dialogue within our communities and to hear from us, and we like to hear from folks, especially when it's constructive ideas about prioritizing on the county budget. It's, you know, we're acting on your behalf, and so it's good to hear from you on a variety of issues besides the ones that you're directly involved with. So thank you. And with that, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Before I say that, Mr. Grant, I'm sure you're going to figure it out. But I wish that there were more Senate bills and Assembly bills that we could opt out of and keep local control. I think that by doing more from a local control standpoint, we can manage this budget a lot better. But it's when we're mandated by other things that beyond our control that we can't. Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you. Thank you all for being here and for your input. It was Mr. Pritchard, always good to see you. Mr. Sinton, and Senior and Junior, good to see you as well. And everyone else, Good to be with you. And with that, we will move to our closed session. I have no request to speak, so a time estimate, Mr. Jensen, please.
20 minutes. 20 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So the board will recess until 1:30. We'll go right in, yes. Thank you.
You're live.
Okay. Welcome back to the Board of Supervisors. Let's get a report out of closed session. Mr. Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Great. Thank you. Entertain a motion on the presentation calendar.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Teixeira. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. Okay. I see Ms. Morgan Marshall back there, so we will begin with Supervisor Patterson reading the rideshare month, which, as I agreed with Supervisor Meacham, every month is rideshare month, right? But please come to the lectern, Morgan, and Supervisor Patterson will read from the longer version.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Morgan. Gives me great pleasure to read a resolution proclaiming October 2011 as Rideshare Month in San Luis Obispo County. Whereas the Board of Supervisors recognizes that 74% of commuters in San Luis Obispo County commute to work by driving alone, which significantly contributes to air pollution, road congestion, and decreased quality of life locally and throughout the state. And whereas the Board of Supervisors recognizes transportation choices, including carpooling, vanpooling, taking the bus, walking, biking, or working from home, serve to preserve air and water quality, improve personal health, reduce road congestion, and reduce commute costs. And whereas SLO Regional Rideshare is a division of the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, provides information, programs, and services on sustainable transportation choices for people living, working, and visiting San Luis Obispo County. And whereas Rideshare Month 2011 is executed by Rideshare and sponsored by the Air Pollution Control District, City of San Luis Obispo, Fun Ride, Ride On, Enterprise, and Regional Transit Authority to encourage people to use sustainable transportation. And whereas Rideshare Month will include cash incentives and outreach events to incentivize transportation choices. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim October 2011 as Rideshare Month in San Luis Obispo County.
Say a few words and promote a few things, perhaps.
Okay,
I'd love to.
Thank you, Supervisor Patterson, and members of the County Board of Supervisors for proclaiming Rideshare Month as October in San Luis Obispo County. We have a lot of things in store for the month, but as you've already heard, really the whole point is to get people to recognize their options. And their options on how to get around this county, whether it be by foot, riding their bike, carpooling, vanpooling, taking the bus, or even working from home. Rideshare Month is about recognizing that these options are different for everyone, and everybody has a commute that's unique to them. But it's about encouraging them to exercise their options and use the tools that we already have in place. And we do that with the best incentive that we have, and that is cash. We give out cash to people to try it for the first time. We give out cash to people who are already using it. And we also give out cash to our advocates and our volunteers who are encouraging others to do it too. And we do it every Friday in October. And in addition, we have events that help remove the barriers. Events such as Transit Tuesdays, where you can ride any bus in San Luis Obispo County free. No strings attached. You just hop right on board. We have Carpool Wednesdays where you can get $20 of free gas to your carpool. Vanpool Thursdays where you can try vanpooling for free. And Bike Fridays where you can go to bike breakfast, bike happy hours, take a bike ed workshop and learn how to feel confident on the road, or even get discounts on tune-ups and accessories for your bike if it's rusty and in your garage. Rideshare Month's a great opportunity and a great excuse to try and commute a different way other than driving alone. And if anything, at the end of the month, you could just end up saving a lot of money on commute costs. All of this information is at rideshare.org. And I also brought some flyers and posters. Maybe I could pass to the clerk, and then she could pass around for all of you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Morgan. Supervisor Patterson has more to add on rideshare.
Well, I just have a question. I was curious. This is the first I've heard of bike happy hours on Fridays, and I'm wondering if you have a bike or a designated biker or how that works exactly.
Right. Well, the point of the bike happy hour is to recognize that we're not just celebrating cyclists when they go to work, but we're also celebrating cyclists when they come from work. And bike happy hour, you know, it's about cycling safely and just enjoying a casual beverage of your choice with other like-minded bicycle commuters.
Great. Thank you.
Sorry that you haven't been invited so far, Supervisor Patterson, but clearly one is forthcoming. Thank
yes.
you.
The
Morgan.
First Friday.
Okay.
We'd love for you to join us.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Ms. Douglas Schatz, we have some outstanding 30-year employees to honor.
You're going to announce B2 as well.
And, B2 is actually going to be held next week to honor John Kelly, so we're going to go to B3.
Thank you, Chairman Hill, members of the board. Human Resources is very pleased to be here to help you recognize employees for their years of dedicated public service. And we have two service awards today, both for 30 years. And when we call your name, if you could come up to the right podium, get your award, and the department head representative could come up to the podium as well. The board will read the resolution, and then you can approach the board, handshakes, photo opportunities, and all that. So without further ado, let's honor Vince Marici for 30 years of service.
Vince, I have a resolution here for your 30 years. Wow.
30 years.
You don't look a day over 40.
He needs glasses.
Whereas Vince Marici began his career at the county in September 1981 as an environmental specialist. Notably, Vince served as project manager of the Sweet Springs Nature Reserve Project, where he was instrumental in obtaining funding for the project and in conservation efforts. And whereas from 1987 to 2000, Vince worked as an emergency services coordinator with the Office of Emergency Services and was promoted in December 2000 to Administrative Analyst 3 with the Administrative Office. And whereas Vince is an effective consultant and liaison to his assigned departments, whereby departments have stated that Vince provides sound customer service to his departments, is professional, and acts with integrity. And whereas Vince continues to serve the people of San Luis Obispo by contributing his vast knowledge, skills, and experience to his current projects, which include the Women's Jail, Juvenile Hall Expansion, and the Homeless Service Center. Whereas Vince's coworkers describe him as being professional, intelligent, dependable, trustworthy, compassionate, a team player, witty, hilarious, and a good friend. These are all in quotation marks, so I'm much they're in italics, and you know, you could that would be sarcastic, but I think they were sincere. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby commend Vince Marici for his 30 years of exemplary service to the people of San Luis Obispo County. And Vince, we have a resolution. So come on.
Congratulations.
You got a photo op. Do you want to bring anyone else up here with you?
Yes,
that would be nice. He's making you make us look good.
Take a picture with our cousin Vinny.
Okay. Here come the paparazzi.
They are in force.
Parks as well are.
Vince, we'll before you, we'll let you say a word, but I think Mr. Grant
would
like to say a few.
So
take the lectern just in case you are roasted.
That's what I'm afraid of. Known him a long time. So.
It's okay. We have human resources here just in case it's too rough.
Shall I go ahead,
Please,
Mr. Chair?
Please, Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Jim Grant, County Administrator. Actually, I'm not going to roast Vince today. We made a deal. We've known each other for, I think, over 20 years. So he's got the goods on me, and I have the goods on him. So it's a standoff at this point in time. So we'll do that later.
That's good.
But I do want to say that Vince and I have worked together for a long time, and at least over 20 years, and I consider him a good friend. And I know that Vince exemplifies what a county employee is all about. He's got great integrity. He's got a strong work ethic, and he has a real strong public service mentality that I think really benefits the people of San Luis Obispo County. He also has a really good grasp of what we need to do within the office to help to make this county a great place to live and work, and Vince really works hard at that. So, and additionally, if we ever need anything in the office that needs detail, Vince is our guy. He can dig in, and he doesn't let go until he has the answers. So we really appreciate him. So I just want to thank Vince for all his years of service, and hopefully lots more, Vince. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I want to join that, too, before we let Vince speak. I've gotten a chance to work closely with him on the one of the projects that was mentioned here is the Homeless Services Center, and he's been an exceptional help on that from the beginning. We've had a lot of good county people involved and continue to be involved, and Vince has been involved on the design end of it, and I know we'll continue to be involved, and I know from talking to the folks in the design committee over in Capslo and so forth, they feel his input has been really, really helpful, and they've made a lot of progress for it. And I can tell from the response today that he is as well regarded by his co-workers as he is by those of us who work with him perhaps intermittently. So with that, Vince, why don't you say a few words?
Thank you. I really appreciate your board's recognition for the 30 years in service. I'm grateful that during that time I've worked with many good professional people here at the county, and I'm proud to work in public service. Working here has allowed my wife and I, Rita, to live in one of the finest places in America, raise and send two children off to college, both of whom are employed now. Thumbs up on that. I've had the opportunity and good fortune to meet many good citizens, be a part of interesting and challenging projects, and develop an appreciation for and respect for the different areas and perspectives that make up our county. Numerous people both within and outside county government have generously shared their advice and guidance with me. I hope that I have occasionally been able to return the favor. And to my friends in the administrative office, you rock. I hope that I've had, I can't think of a better group of people to share the work we do. Thank you. And I know Jim and Dan will appreciate this last comment. Let's get back to work, shall we?
Thank you, Bill. Okay, a true gentleman. Our next employee, Ms. Douglas Schatz?
Is Daryl Daniels of the Parks Department, General Services Agency.
There he is.
Just 1 minute.
Okay. And Mr. Daniels, we'll have Supervisor Gibson read your resolution.
Thank you.
Daniels, welcome and thanks for coming in. Mr. Daniels, welcome and thanks for coming in from the great open spaces to our humble quarters here. Whereas Daryl Daniels began his career with the County of San Luis Obispo as a park gate attendant on July 19, 1981, and whereas Daryl was promoted to the position of Park Ranger 1 on June 6, 1982, and then promoted to his current position as Park Ranger 2 on August 19, 1985. And whereas Daryl provided exceptional service to the communities of San Luis Obispo County with energy and attention to detail for visitors of lake parks and parklands of the North Coast, and whereas Daryl has become known for his concern for safety and efforts to protect park visitors through membership in the County Parks Safety Assessment Team and his training to become one of the County Parks' first emergency medical technicians. And whereas Daryl has been instrumental in mentoring, teaching, and training novice park rangers, some of which have gone on to become supervising rangers, and whereas Daryl exhibited exceptional commitment to park visitors during the snowstorms of the winter of 87-88, my goodness, that's an interesting bit of history, when trapped by snow, he stayed at his post to assist evacuation of Santa Margarita Lake and pulled stranded motorists from snowbanks to safety. And whereas Daryl has proven to be a true professional ranger with exemplary work ethic and desire to prepare county parks and open space for safe and beneficial public recreation, and whereas Daryl Daniels lives his life for parks and recreation, playing and coaching softball teams, leading church youth, and fishing in the High Sierra, now therefore be it resolved and ordered that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize Daryl Daniels for his long term of dedicated service to the residents and visitors of county parks and open space. Mr. Daniels.
Daryl, we'll get a picture here if you wouldn't mind. I know. We don't like it any more than you do, but at least you deserve it.
Get the heavy artillery out.
Stacy, you have to. Okay.
Thank you.
And before we give you a chance to respond, though, we see Jeanette Pell ready to say a few things, Darren.
Good afternoon, Board of Supervisors. I'm Jeanette Pell, the General Services Agency Director. And it's a pleasure to be here today to recognize Daryl Daniels for his 30 years of dedicated service to San Luis Obispo County. As a 30-year employee in county parks, Daryl has seen a lot of change along the way. Daryl has impressed me with his ability to build relationships with county staff and the public and has demonstrated commitment to the parks programs. Daryl is a hard worker. He's creative. He exemplifies all the qualities of an excellent employee. His peers respect him, and his supervisors depend on him. Congratulations on a very impressive milestone of 30 years of county employment, and thank you for all your many contributions to us. And good luck for another 30 years.
Oh, my.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I guess if I was to say anything, it would be thank you for the opportunity not only to work in the county parks, but to try and give back as much as I can. Living here is definitely a privilege, yet at the same time, the journey has been interesting and fun and a challenge. I look back at some of my early pictures. I actually had more hair on top of my head than I do any place else, and my hair wasn't quite as light. But again, I want to thank you. It's been a great journey. And this one will someday soon end. At the same time, I hope I've left a legacy with my coworkers and in the parks. I just appreciate the opportunity. Again, thank you for everything you've given to me and the opportunities that you've presented me with. Thank you.
Okay, that is always a good way to start the afternoon, to see two of our best and most dedicated employees and wish them well. And we'll let people file out as we let our staff get into place. And Madam Clerk, if you would introduce the item C1, please.
C1, a continued hearing to consider an appeal by Verizon Wireless of the Planning Commission's denial of a request by Verizon Wireless Shirley Osabin for a conditional use permit to allow the construction and operation of an unmanned Verizon Wireless communications facility at 1735 Las Tablas Road in the community of Templeton, 1st District. Item was continued from August 16, 2011, and it's recommended denial of the appeal or continue the item off calendar.
Okay. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, I'm going to recuse myself. I don't want to have any perceived conflict of interest. My wife works for Verizon, although it has nothing to do with cell towers. She works for Verizon Business. But I will recuse myself from this discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. As Mr. Meacham exits, we will go to staff first, or do we want to go to the applicant first? How do we want to do this? Mr. Singelwald.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman Hill, board members, Erlen Singelwald, Department of Planning and Building. So this item was continued from August 16th, and before I launch into my presentation this afternoon, I wanted to update your board on some events that have occurred since the last meeting on this project. So Verizon has gone out and has identified an alternative site. It is called the Ames property. It's on Vineyard Drive, and according to Verizon, this alternative site could achieve the proposed project's coverage objective, and as I'm prepared to show in my presentation, we also think this site would avoid or significantly reduce a lot of the land use compatibility concerns raised by the neighbors with the original proposal. However, Verizon intends to submit a conditional use permit application to construct a facility at this alternative site, but Verizon's not prepared to withdraw their appeal until they've received land use approval for the alternative site, which is why they are now requesting that the item be continued off calendar until the alternative, until the project's approved on the alternative site.
Okay, before we go to that, why don't we get the representative from Verizon to explain why it is you would like another continuance. I believe this would be the third.
Correct. Good afternoon. My name is Tricia Knight, representing Verizon Wireless. And the two previous continuances were when the Planning Commission denied us and we appealed the project, we needed a more exhaustive alternative site analysis. So we went out and contacted property owners, looked at the various agencies and things that we have to get approvals for, and that took time to get responses. We didn't just want to come back and say, oh, we never were able to get a hold of them or they never responded. That took several months. In narrowing that down, we did find an alternate candidate. As of, I think it was on, when did we meet there? Was it last Wednesday? Met on site at this alternative site with the fire department, the planning department, members of TAG, the property owner, obviously, and some of the concerned neighbors from the previous project to meet at this site and really make sure that everything was going to be compatible. And it looks like we're moving in that direction. Our overall goal is to submit an application in the next 30 days. The planning department has reviewed the merits of the project preliminarily and indicated that there really doesn't appear to be any issues on the face of it at this point. So we're asking for this six-month continuance because, and I can give a presentation on the alternates that we've considered, but an alternative site analysis begins with the preferential order of placement, meaning that we start with existing structures, then we go to new site builds, and we've done that. So let's say we submit this application, we go through the process and something unforeseen does come up. I don't know what that could be, but we just never know. And the application does not get approved. The application that we currently have in right now then becomes the least intrusive option. The alternative sites that we've looked at have fallen out for either not being able to obtain a lease, not being compatible with the surrounding environment, being it's too close to residential. And I can go through that more in detail if you so choose. So we're asking for this off calendar, and you know, in talking with planning, it looks to be about a five-month time frame that this CUP with this alternate site would take to go through the process. In the event that that goes through, we withdraw this application. We're off building a site that seems everyone's good with. If it doesn't, then we are forced to return to this particular site that we've already spent the time and the money and energy on because it is the least intrusive option. So that's the reasoning behind our request.
Okay. Let me go to our county council on this, if I could. I don't know if Mr. Jensen or Ms. McDonald would like to, I know that there has been some communication with Verizon Wireless's attorneys, and wondered if you might weigh in on that.
Thank you. This is Whitney McDonald from County Counsel's office. Yes, we have been in communications with Verizon's attorneys. The attorney was actually the one who requested this last continuance and has essentially stated the same reasons that Ms. Knight has stated. And it just, given all the various working parts, it may be that allowing a continuance to get this alternative site run down may be the best use of resources at this point in time.
Okay. So as we turn to you for advice, because we know Verizon has made it clear that they think that this continuance is absolutely necessary to their future application, their future conditional use permit application, what would you say is the overriding benefit for us to grant a continuance? We have people here who've been here before and have probably become rather irritated by this process. So what possible reason would we have for not holding the hearing and giving the continuance on this, that you, at least from your opinion?
I think that the alternatives analysis is a very important component of this application as well as the alternate application. At this point in time, we do have information that there is an alternative site. It does appear to be feasible, but the more information we have on that, the better for our record in this application.
Okay. Colleagues, I'll hear from you. Mr. Gibson?
Mr. Chairman, you know, at the last time we opened this hearing, I, for one, and I think I perceived it in colleagues as well, felt that the continuance that brings us to today was the last, and we were assured by Verizon at that point that that was all that they needed to get this nailed down. My inclination on two levels is to proceed with the hearing today. One is that we have inconvenienced a number of folks from the neighborhood who wanted to come down and testify. And again, speaking only for myself, I thought there was reason to continue last time. I'm less convinced of it this time. The second point is that I think at a point we need to judge an application on its merits as it stands before us today, and that includes an alternatives analysis, and I, for one, would like to conduct this hearing and make a decision one way or the other.
On this specific?
On this one. That's my take, and we have three options after hearing the information. I mean, we can uphold the Planning Commission, we can uphold the appellant, and we, after hearing this information, we can continue as well. So that's one supervisor's approach to this.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, as you probably recall, I was in support of holding the hearing last time. But I'm curious, again, Ms. McDonald comments about the alternative analysis that would be of value in determining whether or not this particular application has met all the criteria. And I'm encouraged by the fact that our planning staff has said that they've taken a look at this alternative site, seems to meet the criteria that Verizon needs, as well as the support of the community, at least preliminarily, and that they would withdraw this application if the alternative site is approved. And so, I don't know. I don't know that we need to go through a full hearing this afternoon if it looks like there's another site that the community would support and that meets the criteria. And I would, this time around, be willing to vote for a continuance.
Mr. DeShera.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. I would have to agree with my colleague, Mr. Patterson. I appreciate the public being here and the concise comments they made last time to us about their concerns having this in their neighborhood, in their backyard, and I can appreciate that having gone through a number of these hearings in Napomo. but I think that we're to the point now where we continue it one more time. They come back with the alternative. If they don't, then they both go away.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that they both go away is the necessary result of that. The land use ordinance requires an alternatives analysis and a co-location analysis that I haven't seen at this point because we haven't opened the hearing. But if we'd be back hearing this same item is what I understand, and yeah. Seek clarification on this, and our options for deliberation on this item as it stands now remain the same should the continuance be granted.
Well, it seems redundant to have the hearing about something that we haven't really had a chance, and even some of the community haven't had a chance, and they don't have really a presentation to make at this point. I mean, the applicant, I mean, to me, if we're going to continue, we're going to continue. I don't. Otherwise, we have a hearing to either approve or deny of the existing application.
Right.
That's that.
Right. I mean, that's
okay. So you continuance. You want to have the hearing?
Sir.
Okay. I think we shall continue, but I want to hear from the folks that have come today. A few of them that we have seen from before. So let me start with Mr. Rubin. And then go to Mr. McNamee, if I could.
Good afternoon, supervisors. Thank you for your public service.
And the mic,
photographs.
The mic, Erlen.
Yeah, Mr. Rubin, we'll make sure that you have the time and get everything set up. We'll help you.
Can you hear me? Is the mic on?
I believe so, yes.
Let me see how this works. Before you start the thing, if I get this. Okay, I believe I'm ready. And this is a view from my front door of the proposed Verizon site. It's up on the hill. It's a little blurry from here, but it's directly behind the house that you see there. Here's a closer view as you begin walking down my driveway. And here's a view as you enter this path that's right here. That is the path that leads around these houses. And you can see here a white pole that has been erected by Verizon, which would be the mock pole they refer to that will be the location of a cell tower with antennas on it, not the one with a faux pine. You can't really see because it's white, but here's the water tower right here behind that dead tree. Here's a view from my neighbor's house directly across the street from mine. This is their backyard, and you can see the water tower now. And another view from the backyard. And this space that's in here is the property owned by Lieutenant Colonel Bennett, who's written to you. And as we can see in the next photo, his property line goes right up to where the pole is right now because everything that's been graded is his property. And as far as other locations, I'm wondering about, this is a panoramic, so I'm going to scan it and I'm going to give you these photographs. But you can see here on the right, this is the proposed area. And as you start moving on a 180-degree view here I took, there's a lot of hills back there that are further away from the residences that you can put this. Okay. And the further back view, there's the tower, and you see the street here where our houses are on, and then where they're proposing to put this new application for is right here, which is not a good site in my opinion. I will oppose that because that actually will increase the noise to my backyard because we get the westerly wind coming in there and it brings the noise right into our backyard for anything that's on that hill. There's a neighbor on that hill now. We can hear conversations on that hill. So any level of humming will be worse. And I'm wondering why they don't just go up to this ridge right up here. That's just a little bit further. And there's no housing up there. Or there's plenty of options on Las Tablas, the original location they sought This is right next door to the hospital, a two-story building. You look a little further west, there's another two-story medical building there. On the other side of the street is another two-story building, the bank building, Heritage Oaks Bank. Several two-story buildings in a commercial area seem more suitable than the residential area. Now, this is a little dark, but you can see the hospital is right there. Here's these other towers, these other two-story buildings right next to the hospital. And here's a good view of this area with the two-story buildings, and you'll see plenty of wires and generators on these poles. So it's an area that already is experiencing some hum and some kind of, of the materials that they're looking to put in there. You can see the towers, and these light poles are significantly higher. They can strap one to a pole, and you see these types of things there, these generators that are up there creating noise already. This is the area that I'm wondering, why don't they check this? And you can see here on one of them is a sign that says available. They're looking for tenants. So there's plenty of options. I'm wondering if they've been checked out. And to continue this a third time, to me, is very unreasonable. We were told last time we'd be here that this would be the last continuance, and it was for purposes of bringing their attorney here, who I haven't seen yet, and also for purposes of finalizing a complete plan of many locations. Now today we hear about one other possible location. That's not a complete plan, in my opinion. And we didn't have notice that this other plan, this other option was being discussed today. That wasn't part of the agenda. To the extent it's part of an overall plan to say why this Verizon Osborn site should go forward, fine, we would hear it. But I wasn't prepared to give any testimony on this new site that one of my neighbors, not all of the community, one neighbor was invited to go visit. I saw where it's at, and I can tell you it's not in a more favorable position as far as I'm concerned in my lot. So I ask you to deny the continuance and give a decision today on the hearing that we've had continued several times on the evidence that's before you thus far on this application.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin.
Thank you.
Mr. McNamee, followed by, Becky Gray? Bakai Gray? I'm sorry. Becky, I'm sorry. I couldn't read your writing. But Mr. McNamee, welcome.
Good afternoon. I think we've all come here too many times to have this continued again. And Verizon has been extremely manipulative throughout the entire process. Verizon asked for no continuance before the Planning Commission when it was asked for by all the neighbors because they were not adequately informed or prepared. They did that because we weren't prepared and they thought they would win. They lost before the Planning Commission. They have asked for three continuances before the Board of Supervisors. Alternate sites are required by county ordinance. They should have done alternate site analysis prior to their first application. There's a reason that Verizon was denied by the Planning Commission, Templeton Advisory Group, and there should be a compelling reason to overturn the Planning Commission. I pray that our supervisors, the Board of Supervisors, will not be intimidated by Verizon. The proposed facility would increase noise in a quiet neighborhood. You've already heard this. We can hear children play up the street. We can hear a conversation. We can hear crickets at night. According to Verizon, this facility would produce 65 dB of noise. Air conditioning unit produces 60 dB of noise. The freeway produces 70 dB. We're talking about a significant amount of noise in a very quiet rural environment. The reason that we all moved to this neighborhood and the community in general. There's many reasons. We've gone through them numerous times. The facility would be an eyesore. It wouldn't be consistent with the residential rural nature of the location. The proposed facility would reduce flow of wildlife. Other wireless towers would be allowed preference to this site, which would increase the problem that we already face. Verizon has never and did not adequately seek alternate location as required by county ordinance. This site that the water tower is on currently is about a half an acre. It was partitioned off years ago strictly to provide a location for the water tower. At that time, all the surrounding areas were over 10 acres, but they carved up a little niche just for the water tower. Now we're talking about putting a communications facility up there and other things, and maybe in the future other wireless towers. It wasn't planned for this originally. They're talking about setbacks on this that are 5 feet. On my property, which I'm less than a half an acre, the setback in the back of my property is 15 feet. And this is adjacent to much larger pieces of property, so it just doesn't make sense to me. And I would hope that the Board of Supervisors would deny it at this time. I hate just having to keep coming back here, but we want to make sure that our voice is heard. Thank you very much for your time, and we appreciate your service.
Thank you, Mr. McNamee. Ms. Gray, followed by Williams Sporleader.
Hi. So we've been up here a lot, and we appreciate you listening to us every time. I do have a request that you deny the original application that's been put before you for the Ossipon site. And there's numerous reasons for that. I mean, my neighbors and myself have alluded to that several times. The bottom line is, regardless of what alternative site they come with, the Ossipon site is the wrong site, it's the wrong location, and it's not good for the neighbors, it's not good for the community, nobody wants it there. The other thing, the next site, I was part of the group, I was the one neighbor that actually went. Initially said that I would gladly volunteer and help go to other sites. I did appreciate Verizon reaching out to me to do so. I was the one neighbor that took advantage of that. The site, I must commend Verizon because their plan and their design for this alternative site is way better than a pole. I mean, they actually are listening to neighbors as far as visual aesthetics, and they do realize that that is important. However, there are a lot of concerns. We did have a neighbor meeting afterwards. We did a walkthrough, showed them the location, listened to the sound that we hear from our backyards, and noise is a big concern for all the neighbors. One of my suggestions was that the ridgeline, I originally emailed some ideas to Verizon stating, hey, these are the key streets that I would look at as far as the community goes, and prime locations to put to use as an alternative site. I only saw the one alternative site come through. I would love to see a list from Verizon of, hey, we reached out to X, Y, and Z. Here's the spreadsheet of everything we got. Here's the letter signed off saying no, they would not like or be interested in an alternative site here, because I don't think we've ever asked them for that, and I think that's important. We want them as a business to do their homework. I don't feel we're required to do their homework for them. I think that's something that they should be showing us ahead of time. Again, the alternative site is way better than this one, but is it the best site? Again, I don't think so. I request that you deny this current application because the comment that it's basically not the least intrusive, it is the most intrusive to our neighborhood. TAG's denied it. The county planning has denied it. Everybody's denied it. Everybody realizes that. So the fact that we just keep dragging it along, it doesn't even matter. Whether the second site goes through or not, it's still the wrong location. The other thing is just the bottom line is that we ask that you deny this continuance, and let's just end this, move forward. If we need to be involved in other applications and other proposals that they bring forward, then that's fine. But this one that's on the table today, the Ossipon site, needs to be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gray. Mr. Sporleader?
Good afternoon, Board. My name is Bill Sporleader. It seems to me that the can has been kicked down the road enough already. The residents of Templeton have been here four times to voice their reasons why this communication tower should not be at this proposed location. Templeton Area Advisory Group, which is our land use recommendation team, does not support placement at this location. The Planning Commission has already voted to deny. The planning staff has offered Exhibit A to deny the project. It appears the wireless company might even have seen the light of reason, except that as I looked through the 130 pages online regarding this appeal, something caught my eye. On pages 1 and 2, there's a letter from San Francisco that is requesting yet another continuance for 6 months or so. This letter, while seemingly offering to solve the dispute, is not only requesting another delay, but is also waving a weapon. As a resident of San Luis Obispo County, this is unacceptable. Even after all of the prior requests have been granted, if this new request is not granted and their appeal is denied, the sending of a loaded gun to this building is beyond my comprehension. to assure litigation as the only protection of the client's rights is not only in bad taste, but downright dangerous to the process that all have worked so hard to advance. Today, I ask you to please change your comments. Today, send a message. We do not appreciate, nor do we allow, the brandishing of weapons. I ask that you listen to TAG, the Planning Commission, your staff, our staff, and, of course, the residential citizens who will live with your decision 24 hours a day. Please, today, hear and deny this appeal regarding the conditional use permit DRC 2009-57 based on the Exhibit A findings. Please stop the kicking of the can. It's dented. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sport Leader. And that'll do it for public comments, so we'll bring it back to the board. Supervisor Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Singewald, was Verizon noticed that there would be the possibility of holding a hearing this afternoon, that their request for continuance was not a given?
Absolutely.
Okay, and Ms. McDonald, being that we've continued twice already, and one of the things that needs to be submitted that hasn't been is the alternative analysis. In fact, we asked for that last time and perhaps the first time as well. The fact that they've had the opportunity but not done that, is that adequate?
That's a good question, and I think the lines are a little bit blurry there. Definitely, it is within your discretion to deny the continuance and hold the hearing, and if it seems right to, you know, deny the CUP. And the case law on this subject, on whether or not the question is really, are we prohibiting the provision of wireless communication services? And there's a two-part test to that. Is there a significant gap in coverage? And is this application the least intrusive means necessary to fill that gap in coverage? And that's where the term came from that Ms. Knight had referred to. And the alternatives analysis, typically, it should be submitted from the outset so that we know that this really is the least intrusive means necessary. The courts look to whether or not the applicant has proven an initial case, carried an initial burden that this is the least intrusive means necessary. And the courts have said that is shown through an alternatives analysis. Once that burden is met, then it is our burden to produce evidence that there is a technologically feasible and available alternative. So we're still at that first stage of trying to figure out, have they actually carried that initial burden of proving that this is the least intrusive means necessary? And that, of course, is actually after you get through the significant gap in coverage prong. But right now, I think we're looking at the least intrusive means part.
Yes, and I understand that, and thank you for that explanation. What I'm curious about, though, is it the responsibility of the applicants to provide that information and make their case? And they have had opportunities to do that, yet haven't provided that information when we've specifically asked for it.
I think that's a fair argument to make.
Thank you.
Well, another question, if I could, for counsel, and Mr. Sporlitter brought it up and alluded to it a few times, that Verizon has essentially told us that they think if we do not continue this, that they might take action. So I guess what we're asking opinion-wise is it reasonable for us to continue it? And I understand the argument, you know, let's not – and it was made by a couple of people, don't let Verizon intimidate the county, et cetera. But we also know that, well, these are complicated issues when it comes to self towers. They're never easy decisions, and there are other entities that we are preempted from making decisions based on some other aspects of cell towers too. So we do try to take it seriously so that at some point we get to the best decision possible. So I guess from your opinion, do they have a reasonable argument to make, and would it make it difficult for the county, or would the county have to spend resources in defending itself on a decision not to continue? Is essentially what we're, I think, what's most helpful to us.
Well, what we do have is a letter from the applicant's attorney saying that they will sue if we deny their application.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, kind of as clear as you can get. But and in addition, the applicant would be working with a 30-day statute of limitations, so they may feel like it is necessary to file a lawsuit on this application while still pursuing the alternative site. We would most assuredly have to spend resources defending that lawsuit. I think it's definitely not clear that it would be a losing battle on our side.
Mr. Jensen?
I was going to say that if a lawsuit is filed, it would most likely be in a federal district court down in Los Angeles, and that becomes more burdensome for us to defend a case of that nature. We've had that experience recently with a case that ended up in district court. And there's never any certainty in a case like this. There are a lot of potential issues that, you know, there's definitely some risk if we are drawn into litigation on this thing.
Okay. Mr. Singel?
Yeah, I would like to add something. We have an alternative site analysis from Verizon. It's right here. I haven't had an opportunity to closely evaluate it, but as we heard Verizon say, the conclusion of the alternative sites analysis is that there is an alternative candidate that is technically feasible from an RF perspective, and you know, based on my site visit last week, I think there's a good chance that is a less intrusive alternative compared to the proposed project.
Mr. Gibson?
In fact, Mr. Chairman, I think I heard Ms. Knight say that it was a less intrusive alternative, because she argued quite clearly that should it not pan out in qualitative terms, that this would become the less intrusive alternative. And my logic of that says that there's clearly a less intrusive alternative. My point being that we are now at least one hearing at the Planning Commission and three hearings at the Board of Supervisors, and Verizon has yet to present us an alternatives analysis as required by our land use ordinance. And so that was the part of the basis of, well, and so I think we hear what the contents of that are, and make a decision on the application before us.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, I'm curious, Mr. Singelwald, are you prepared to give us a summary of what that alternative analysis includes, the applicant can do that? Okay, very good. Given that, I would support proceeding with the hearing today.
Okay. You're on.
All right, let me find my notes here. So, so this item is an appeal by Verizon of the Planning Commission's denial of a proposed wireless communications facility. The facility will consist of a total of 9 panel antennas, 6 antennas on a 40-foot-tall faux pine tree, commonly called a monopine, and 3 panel antennas on a 20-foot monopole. The facility also would involve 6 prefabricated equipment cabinets and a diesel generator located within approximately 1,000-square-foot equipment area and also associated utility trenching. Here's a vicinity map showing the project site. You can see here it's on the very western edge of the Templeton URL. It's approximately 500 feet south of Los Tablas Road. The site's in the residential suburban land use category. Here's an aerial photograph. You can see Ventoux Vineyards located on the parcel immediately to the west of the project site. The two parcels surrounding the other three sides of the property are designated for residential use. However, they're currently used as dry farming, as you can see in this aerial photograph. Also, as we've heard, Mr. Bennett owns this property here, and he has submitted plans showing his intention one day to build a home approximately in this location here in the center of the parcel. Here's the aerial photograph again, zoomed in a little closer on the project site. You can see the water tank here, the monopine will be located right here, and the 20-foot monopole will be located here, tucked into the trees and painted a dark green color to blend with those existing cypress trees. Here's the site plan. Again, six antennas on a 40-foot monopine, three antennas on a 20-foot monopole. Equipment area is located here, and the telco utilities would come from Las Tablas Road and follow the dirt access road here to the equipment area. Here's an enlarged site plan showing the same thing. This is showing the equipment shelter, or I'm sorry, these are outdoor equipment cabinets, not a shelter, and the generator enclosed within this 1,000 square foot fenced area. And elevations. So here is a photo simulation of the project site from Las Tablas Road. You can see the proposed 40-foot monopine here. It just barely silhouettes against the sky. It's generally in line with the existing tree line there, and it wouldn't be immediately noticeable as a wireless facility, although it does. It does partially silhouette, and if not properly designed, too, the monopines can be very noticeable as communications facilities, which is not consistent with our ordinance. Now, here's a photo simulation taken from within the project site. So this isn't a public view. It's just really meant to show how the equipment cabinets and generator would look within the fenced enclosure. You can also see the monopine here would just barely stick up above the water tank. So as we saw earlier already, the applicant, Verizon, also installed a mock-up of a 20-foot tall monopole just to verify that it would not extend above the tree line. This is a photograph of that mock-up. So as you can see here, the 20-foot monopole would be visible from the Wildwood subdivision to the south of the project site. The original idea is, of course, to paint the monopole a dark green color, matte finish, so it would blend in to the vegetation there and would not be discernible as a communications facility. And here again is the mock-up of the monopole from between homes from Ironwood Place. So, co-location analysis. When co-location is not proposed, such as in this case, the ordinance requires applicants to consider the feasibility of co-locating the facility at an existing facility. In other words, what's the feasibility of locating this Verizon facility at a site where we already have telecommunications facilities? So this site, this map here shows the five nearest existing facilities to the project site. And the first thing I'll point out here is at the Miller site and in downtown Templeton on the Grain Building, Verizon already has facilities. So those aren't viable co-location candidates. Verizon's already there. They're already achieving their coverage objectives in those areas. That leaves the Logicano site here, which is located along the Highway 46 corridor, situated to provide coverage in that area and would not provide coverage, would not meet the project's coverage objective of the western end of town. Similar situation with the Young site. This site is designed to provide coverage in the northern portion of Templeton and would not meet the project's coverage objective. The Templeton CSD site, this is a compound with a few water tanks at the end of Lincoln Road. There are several carriers located there. Verizon is not there. Verizon indicates that they are able to achieve their coverage objective in this part of town from the Grain Building location and therefore do not require a site here. And if Verizon were to co-locate here, they are stating that it would not meet the coverage objective of Las Tablas Road. And I believe they have RF maps verifying all of those claims that they're ready to present. Now, the other requirement of the ordinance is the preferential placement of facilities, as you heard the applicant speak of earlier. This is a requirement for carriers to consider locating antennas on existing structures before proposing to construct a new antenna support structure, such as the proposed monopine and monopole. So one of the natural alternatives to consider in that case is locating the antennas on the water tank rather than on new monopoles. That would be consistent with the ordinance requirement. Of course, it would not address many or any of the neighbors' concerns, since it would be located in the same place. And from a visual screening perspective, the proposed project is actually a preferable alternative because the antennas would be screened better than if they were just located on the side of the water tank. Now, also, there's the Twin Cities Hospital building, which is actually, it was Verizon's very first candidate for this project, but at the end of the day, they weren't able to negotiate a lease with the hospital, and they did provide me a written statement from the CEO of the hospital verifying that. Now, okay, here is the Ames site. This is the project site that we had a pre-application meeting at last week. It is located about 2,000 feet south of the project site, and this is the Wildwood subdivision here and the open space parcel for the Wildwood subdivision. You see it's located further from residential areas, and it also, from a planning perspective and as far as consistency with the visual screening requirements of the ordinance, is located further away from major public viewing corridors, particularly Los Tablas Road here and Vineyard Drive to the south here. The Verizon's preliminary proposal would be a faux water tank structure, which would be compatible with the agricultural character of the surrounding area. So, as I stated earlier, this is essentially the conclusion of Verizon's alternative analysis, that there is this other site where the coverage objective of the facility could be achieved, where they have a willing landowner, and where a facility could be designed which complies with the screening requirements and other requirements of our ordinance. Now, you've heard many of the concerns of the community, and these concerns were largely the basis for the Planning Commission's denial of the project. The project site is located adjacent to the Wildwood open space parcel. The neighbors have reported seeing a lot of wildlife utilize this area. They believe the project site and the surrounding open space parcel provides habitat connectivity, which could be impacted by the proposed facility. There's potential for the facility to increase the ambient noise levels. There are just general land use compatibility concerns. The facility is perceived by neighbors as a commercial or industrial use that is inappropriate in this residential neighborhood. And finally, one of the key concerns is that the applicant just has not considered other less intrusive alternatives. Now, Verizon's appeal is essentially a statement that the Planning Commission's denial of this project violated the Federal Telecommunications Act, and they're asking your board to reverse that decision. So I want to provide a brief summary of the relevant provisions of the Telecommunications Act and what Verizon's claims are under each of these sections. First of all, it's important to point out that the Telecommunications Act actually affirms local authority to regulate the placement, construction, and modification of wireless facilities. However, it does, of course, place some very important limitations on that authority. The probably the most well-known limitation and most controversial one is the ban on consideration of radio frequency issues when considering a wireless facility. Verizon has indicated in their appeal that they believe the Planning Commission's denial was largely based on radio frequency concerns and resulting impacts to property values. In fact, however, as I
As I just explained, the Planning Commission decision was based on concerns regarding potential visual impacts, noise impacts, and general land use compatibility concerns, not on the radio frequency emissions. And the project, moving along, the other applicable provision of the Telecommunications Act requires localities to act within a reasonable amount of time on projects. Pretty recently, the Federal Communications Commission has interpreted a reasonable amount of time to mean within 150 days of a project for a new facility that is not a co-location facility. The Planning Commission's decision on the project was within 150 days of the acceptance date of the application. So the county's decision was consistent with that provision. The Telecommunications Act also requires any decision to deny a wireless communications facility to be in writing. The Planning Commission's decision is well documented in the minutes of the Planning Commission meeting and also in the findings attached to your resolution. Telecommunications Act also prohibits discrimination against carriers. Here, Verizon is mentioning how the county has approved several wireless facilities at the Templeton CSD site on Lincoln Road, which is also close to residential areas. Verizon is claiming that we are discriminating against Verizon because we've approved applications by other carriers in similar situations. However, we, of course, review projects based on their own merits, and in this particular case, given the facts presented to the Planning Commission and the public testimony, that we concluded that it wasn't supportable. And finally, the last one here is the most complicated, and I'm not going to go into it in detail because I think Ms. McDonald already did a great job discussing this. So when you hear terms such as significant gap in coverage and the least obtrusive means for closing that gap, it relates to this provision of the Telecommunications Act, which states that localities shall not prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting wireless service. Now, it's very obvious if a local jurisdiction adopts an ordinance that bans wireless facilities altogether, that would be a clear violation of this section. Where it's less clear is when an individual facility is denied. You know, does that constitute an effect of prohibiting wireless service? And as Ms. McDonald noted, the courts have ruled that it can when the carrier is able to show that the proposed facility was closing a significant gap in coverage and that it was the least intrusive means for doing so. And, of course, in this case, you know, the applicant previously had not submitted enough information for us to know whether or not this project was the least intrusive means, and the current information in the record, in fact, suggests that there is another less intrusive alternative available, which is also technically feasible. So with that, staff recommends that your board reject Verizon's appeal and deny the conditional use permit based on the findings in Exhibit A.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Singwell. The question quickly, what causes the noise from the towers?
The noise from the towers comes from the outdoor equipment cabinets, the cooling fans in the equipment cabinets, and also this facility has a proposed generator which emits noise. However, the generator, of course, doesn't run 24 hours a day. It's there as a backup if the batteries in the equipment cabinets fail.
Okay, and so it's interpretation that the noise issue is not related to the radio frequency issues from which we're preempted from.
Correct. There's no connection, yeah.
Ms. McDonald, do you concur?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. Further questions for Mr. Singwald? I will let the applicant, Ms. Knight, please, 10 minutes if you would like.
Once again, Tricia Knight with Verizon Wireless. Mr. Singwald's going to go ahead and put the alternative site analysis. I'm just going to take just a couple minutes to summarize sort of how we got here. Originally, when we submitted the application, we did go to TAG. We actually originally had a much taller monopine to get all the antennas in one place. Had to go to TAG, got that approved. Planning came back and said, we want that monopine shorter. We don't like it silhouetting over the water tank in the skyline. Went back to TAG, got that approved. The problem that we see what happened with the neighbors is it doesn't appear that TAG had a great notification program for noticing the neighbors in the immediate vicinity of the property, but there was by no means any negligent effort on our part to go around the process or not have anyone be aware of those details of the project. Excuse me. Alternative sites were submitted with the project. As Mr. Singwald stated, we originally looked at going on the water tank, which is a minor use permit for us, would have been much simpler. And also co-locating on anything in the surrounding area. It was at the Planning Commission hearing, as the neighbors had stated, that they wanted a more detailed alternative site analysis at that time. We submitted a noise study to planning staff during the two continuances. We did get a noise study done for the outdoor equipment as well as the generator. Both of those equipment, the equipment cabinet and the generator, meet the noise standards for the area and the county's noise ordinance standard. We were going to further attenuate the noise from the equipment cabinets by putting noise baffling fencing around it to even bring it down to negligible levels. And also had the potential to remove the generator entirely from the project to not have to worry about that noise aspect of it at all either. The photo sims were taken a long time ago. The photos that you saw that the gentleman brought up of a more recent you can see there's dead and dying trees around the facility, and we were open to having new plantings as part of conditions of approval and removing those dead trees. And so now I'll go ahead and start with the alternative site analysis. If you can go to the first slide. Can you see it on your monitors? So the next slide will outline the various sites that we considered, and then the map is where they are geographically to our project site. So Mr. Seinwald basically already went through the co-location sites C1, C2, and C3, which were the existing potentially co-locatable sites that we looked at. We're already at one of them. Templeton CSD is too close to the existing site. It really doesn't do anything. We're already covered adjacent to the highway. And then the Logicano property is completely on the other side of the hills, if you will, on Highway 46. So it really doesn't cover the area that we're trying to cover either. And so in preferential order, the very next thing we do is go to existing structures. At the time when we submitted this application in 2009, we had approached the hospital and were not able to reach a deal at that time. When we came back to do a more exhaustive alternative site analysis, we went back to the hospital and once again approached them because times change, economics and so forth, and they came back once again. One of the things that we have to have is 24-hour access to our sites for emergencies in the case that it goes down. We have to be able to get there to maintain that facility. And because it's a hospital, that's kind of a conflict. If we're on a rooftop, excuse me, there's not they need to have a secure facility, and it's hard to get us that 24-hour access, as well as what we call termination rights, which means that either party should be able to terminate at any time, and they were not comfortable with Verizon being able to terminate. So the lease was not able to be reached. And so that the hospital being sort of where we started with this, we sort of branched out in that commercial area along Los Tablas. If you look at the map, thank you. So number 6 on the map, so you'll see our project site in red. Number 6 on the map is the Twin Cities Hospital. And then I'll take you sort of just down Los Tablas. If right across the street, number 4 is the Templeton Medical Center. And this would be further away from residential zones, but one of the obstacles is when we're trying to screen antennas. We've got 9 antennas that we need to get on a rooftop to not add too much mass and also meet the screening standards for the ordinance. And so it becomes tall, bulky, and not really feasible. By the time you get 9 6-foot panel antennas on a rooftop, on the corners, it becomes too massive. And so I'm not, basically, we can't meet the screening standards because the mass of this structure is going to be too large on that building. And so if you've ever driven down Las Tablas and looked across the highway or across the street on Las Tablas from the hospital, you're going to see a row of trees and some medical buildings. And so we would have to clear those trees along with being on top of the building. So, and then going down, we approached Ockmar Medical Plaza, and multiple times, and I have the tracker that shows the times and days that we tried to contact them and recontact them, and no response. As we move further down, number five, which is Ernest Gonzalez, it's actually on a hilltop, the Gonzalez property on a hilltop, surrounded by residential, really great for RF would be probably ideal, but it's literally would be in his backyard, surrounded by residences. It would be a tree, was what we were proposing. So once again, not less intrusive. It's literally in someone's backyard. Going down Las Tablas to number two, which is the Ventu Winery, which is directly behind the proposed site. Would also, there's a little grove of trees behind the winery, but Ventu Winery had been contacted and to no avail. I believe they were one of the neighbors in opposition to the facility to begin with. And then the very last one is number one, which is the Osborne property, which is very removed, and it would be up on a hilltop adjacent to someone's primary residence but not close to any other residences. But it just, and we were able to obtain a lease, probably zonable, being that it's got some trees that we could add a monopine into, but from a radio frequency perspective, doesn't meet that coverage objective. And so if you go down to the third page, Erlyn, thank you. At the bottom, you'll see the components that it takes for a site to really come together and have all of those aspects make the site viable. You have to be able to obtain a lease. We have to be able to zone the project. It has to be constructible, meaning that power and telephone and the things that it requires to power that facility and access are all readily available. And then the radio frequency engineer has to look at the site and know that when they spend the time and money on that particular facility, that it's going to meet the objectives, whether it be coverage or capacity. And you'll see for various reasons, and we can go through them more in detail if you would like, but one or more of those aspects fall out of every single candidate except for number seven, which is the Ames property, which is our primary alternate site that we will be submitting that application on, and then the existing site. So that, in summary, is the alternates that we looked at. It took quite a bit of time once we started doing the more exhaustive alternative site analysis to approach an owner. We send out a letter. If we don't hear back, we follow up with a phone call, and then another letter, another phone call, and just making sure that we had done our due diligence and either really made an effort and not gotten a response or waited to actually get something in writing from the hospital. So that was the part that took the most time. And I'm available to answer any specific questions.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Knight, when was the alternative analysis completed?
It was
the one you submitted today.
The one I submitted today was final, really, as of when we had the meeting last Wednesday to see if that alternative site was really going to work.
Okay.
So.
And so that information wasn't available until then.
That's correct. I wanted to make sure that that really was a viable alternative before we came before you, so that we had something to go.
Okay.
On.
And Mr. Singelwald, could you put the aerial of the sites back up, please? According to the table, it was number five that met all the criteria, I think, but zoning. Can you speak to that issue?
I can a little bit. Yeah, if you if you ever get, next time you're out there, just to look up the hill, and you'll see it's a dominant hill right across the street from the hospital, but it's all single-family residences. Mm. So we've, you know, located in these types of environments before, but just knowing the neighbor's concerns over our proximity now, I could not imagine that would be any more supported being much closer. So our goal was to get further away, being able to meet all those other criteria that I spoke of.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Knight, in the proposed project, you have a monopine and a monopole. Why isn't the monopole also a monopine?
It's definitely a feasible option. We were just thinking, if you've ever seen, it's called the Myers property. It's up above Morrow Bay. There's a ring of trees very similar to this, And there's
they're all artificial.
Exactly. So they're not all artificial, but sometimes you can place poles in the nooks of trees, if you will, and once you paint them green, they do kind of disappear. Now, mind you, when we originally came to this site, we did not know that we were assuming that all that was dry farming, and we really had no idea of knowing that the colonel was going to have a house there at the time or any of the subdivision issues that had come up after that. So it definitely can be a tree. We were just thinking, due to what we've done in the past, that this might be a less intrusive ways of screening it.
And you referenced a noise study. When was that submitted?
That was submitted during one of the continuances. I'll go with between the first and second, or maybe the second and this one, I'm not sure. But we did get a noise study done and submitted it to staff, and it gives the noise summary, but it does state that we are within the county thresholds for noise.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, Ms. Knight, we'll give you a few minutes rebuttal after we hear from some. Since I did the unusual thing of opening up public comment earlier, I would ask if you would like to comment that you stick to things that we have not heard, that have either you have not spoken to us today or have not been reported as part of your perhaps your opposition when it came before the Planning Commission was reported by Mr. Singelwald. So with that, we still will give each of you 3 minutes if you would like to impart some new information on us. And we'll start with Mr. Rubin.
Thank you, Chairman Hill and Supervisors. I do have 3 points to make. One point is that, as County Council has advised us, we get to the site analysis, which was just submitted today. We didn't have a chance to review, only if there is a gap in coverage. If my memory serves me right, we had the engineer from Verizon testify earlier that there is not a gap in coverage. And I'm testifying today that there's not a gap in coverage because my Verizon cell phone works just fine there. So the whole issue of is there a gap in coverage, I submit there is not. It may be that they are trying to increase capacity, which I recall the engineer talking about. That's a whole different issue. So you have more leeway to deny when there is a desire to increase capacity than you would if there is a gap in coverage. That's one point. Second point is that the federal statute requires a fairly quick action on a local government's decision. And I heard that it was 150 days. The time frame in which this body, this local government, the County Board of Supervisors, has held on to this item, I believe is right about at 150 days. Any further continuance would actually possibly put you in violation of statute. So I don't know that granting the continuance is even something that you would want to do, because that could be then twisted and turned around as an appeals ground that you didn't act within a certain reasonable amount of time. And finally, the third point I'd bring up is that if this other location that we've just found out about today is meeting all the requirements and it's in a neighbor's backyard, have the Verizon people talk to those neighbors. Maybe they don't object to that. We do. And it is in our backyard. And the one who's the closest is 5 feet away from the actual cell tower. That's Lieutenant Colonel Bennett, who's registered his opposition to it. So I submit to you on numerous counts, this is still a denial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin. Ms. Gray?
Thank you. Just a couple points I wanted to point out. I believe Tricia commented on the photos, but again, those photos are completely wrong and erroneous. You're wrong. Sorry. The photos, for one, the trees are dead. I mean, they're not. They have a disease. They're not going to last. Even if you replanted, it would take quite some years before those regrew. The other thing is the photos that are in the report are taken from the wrong angle. They're actually not from our backyard, as stated in the report that they were taken. They're actually from the opposite side of the hill. So when you look at the way the pole is set back in the tree line, that's incorrect. If you looked at it from our side, you would see that actually the pole sticks out about 10 to 15 feet from the tree line. So So that's another thing that we just need to pay attention to. The other one is the noise with the AC. I get it that they did the noise report, but it's North County. Of course, the equipment's going to get hot. You know, we're triple digits probably today. So, of course, we're going to hear a lot of noise. And, again, we're in an extremely quiet rural area. A lot of you guys probably live in those types of areas where you hear everything. We can hear those people talk at the top of the water tower. Safety's an issue for me. There's a lot of kids that tend to party up there, unfortunately, but we can hear their conversations up there. So we're definitely going to hear that noise travel right down the hill. The one thing that I am concerned about is I am a Verizon subscriber. I get terrific service up there. I use it for my internet. I use it for my phone. I use it for everything. But the ridge lines that I suggested when Tricia contacted me to say, hey, do you have any suggestive sites? I suggested the ridge lines that were, if you put that map back up that showed all her points, that were actually south and west of that where everything was that was basically sampled. There was nothing that was reached out to those ridge lines that we suggested. And I don't know if you're able to put that back up or not.
Can you please, Madam Clerk? Thank you. Which map did you want, Ms.?
So this one. Okay, so if you look at from my view, the bottom left corner there. So 7, I believe it's number 7. I can't even see those. Are pretty fine points. But 7 is the new proposed site, I believe, is what they're saying. So my suggestion was everything south, there's a huge ridgeline out there that's even a higher elevation. And then also around up Vineyard, there's another ridgeline there. The coverage gap that they're having problems with is actually where the elementary school is, which is on Vineyard Avenue. And I know because I pick up every day there. And, yes, I lose service there, and it stinks. However, our hill site there is the one that's proposed with the Ospen site is actually a lower elevation than Site 7, which is the current new site that's proposed or, I guess, started in pre-planning. So it's even a lower site. So I don't think, I mean, I don't know the studies, but to me it makes more sense to put the site where you're losing coverage, not in an area that already has perfect coverage. My other concern is that, you know, they keep saying that they reached out, they followed TAG in the beginning, they went to TAG, TAG approved it. According to TAG, and when we went to TAG and finally were notified about it the second time asking them to deny it and reverse their approval, was that no one even from Verizon showed up at the TAG meeting. The TAG board actually said that the paperwork was submitted, and they saw paperwork come through, and that was done back and forth, but no one actually was there and showed up. And to me, Tricia said that she was there, but I just have trouble with that because to me it's like if your community is important enough, then get there. I'm here. I've been here 3 times. Do I want to be here? No. I've got a savory event this weekend that's driving us crazy. But I have to be here, and I'm making the time to be here. And I think that's important to just be truthful with your word.
So thank you, Ms. Gray.
I recommend denial.
Okay. Anyone else? Mr. McNamee, are you interested as well? Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what Gary had said earlier. My understanding from last time is that there is not a coverage issue, but more of a capacity issue, and that it sounds like that they would have to offload some stuff if there's more demand in Atascadero. Since there's not a coverage issue, I don't believe that it creates a problem. As Becky and Gary both said, I have Verizon and plan to continue it if we don't have a site up there. But we don't have any problem with cell phone coverage. We get great coverage. And it doesn't. If capacity is an issue, I would hate for a decision to be made based on the fact that somebody can play games on the internet on their phone. You know, that just doesn't seem like a compelling need. Anyway, I recommend that you deny it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, those angry birds are very addictive. We'll give Ms. Knight 5 minutes to offer a rebuttal.
I'm just going to take a minute, and then I am going to bring the radio frequency engineer up to give very specific answers to those questions, as he's definitely more the expert than I am. But I can guarantee you that I was at both of those TAG meetings. I remember specifically attending them. I was the only one there. There was no member of the community there, so I really didn't see any opposition at that time. I do know that due to the proximity of this property, that I think the 300-foot noticing, it didn't quite reach a lot of them, so it was by word of mouth. but I can definitely assure you that we did try to go through the right paths. I think I'm going to go ahead and defer it over to Dwayne Bonham with Verizon. He's the RF engineer, and he can answer any questions.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Dwayne Bonham, RF engineer for Verizon Wireless. Just to speak a little bit about the gap in coverage gap issue that we have here. I would classify this site as being kind of 70% capacity, 30% coverage. However, unless we build something to offload the capacity, it will eventually become a coverage issue. We're currently serving this area from Atascadero and Paso Robles, from very long distance from hilltop sites. Those sites can only carry a set amount of capacity, especially out at the edge of the cell site, and that's currently what they're doing. Templeton is at the edge of those cells. Therefore, it's exhausting the capacity for Atascadero and Paso Robles, the core areas around those particular sites. By building something here that is relatively close to the usage, and we can tell where the usage is, we can offload that, get it. We can increase, have a site there that will provide good capacity into the future, and it will free up capacity in Atascadero and Paso Robles, improving our service in those communities also. As I speak to the ridge lines that are out there that have been suggested, runs into the same problem. Once again, we'd be serving a high-capacity area at the edge of the cell site. You don't get a lot of capacity out of a cell site when you're doing that. And therefore, those, from an RF perspective, are not good candidates. The other aspect of those is there's no power on those ridge lines, which presents a big problem with us constructing something on those ridge lines.
Okay.
See if there's anything else we need to cover. That's about it.
Questions?
Any questions?
Okay. No. Thank you, then. Okay. I will then close it to the public and bring it back to the board for deliberation and action. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions of staff. Are you familiar with the gap in coverage information that's been alluded to here? I mean, is that part of our record that we have taken on information that shows something that we could call a gap in coverage?
The applicant has submitted radio frequency coverage maps and also capacity maps, which I understand it's a, they're just recently able to actually map capacity. And those, I can't say whether or not they show a gap in coverage. It's not part of... It's not a requirement of our ordinance, so that's not part of the planning review.
Okay. How about the noise study that Ms. Knight referred to that's come in before today's hearing? Staff report suggests there's a potential for exceedances of the county noise ordinance at the property line. She's claiming there's not now under some new set of conditions. Do you have comment on that?
Yeah, I did review the noise study, and the noise study did conclude that the project would meet the noise limits at existing residences, particularly on Ironwood Place. And in fact, the applicable limit is 55 dBA during the daytime and 45 dBA during the evening. The noise report concluded that the facility would generate noise at a level of 31 dBA at the homes on Ironwood Place. What the noise study did not do is it did not evaluate the level of noise emitted from the facility at the adjacent residential property line, which is required by our noise element. The noise study stated that the noise emitted from the equipment would reach 69 dBA at a distance of 5 feet. The equipment is set back about 10 feet from the property line. So it wasn't evaluated in the noise study, but there's a good possibility that it would exceed the 45 dBA evening standard at 10 feet since it's 69 dBA at only 5 feet.
And again, that's cooling equipment, and then on top of that, whatever exercise of the backup generator might be required.
Right, and the 69 dBA is just the cooling fans.
Okay. In your presentation, you referenced the criteria upon which we make our decisions based on our land use authority, that there needs to be a gap in coverage, and we need to show that this is the least intrusive solution to that. And I wonder where in our land, can you point in our land use ordinance where the concept of least intrusive solution to covering a gap pops up, or is that policy? Where do we come to that idea?
Okay, maybe I wasn't clear on this. So the Telecommunications Act states that local government shall not prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the provision of personal wireless communication service. Now, that shall not have the effect of prohibiting wireless service. When a local jurisdiction denies a project, if the applicant shows that that project would close a significant gap in coverage and that the project is the least intrusive means for closing that significant gap in coverage, then the denial of that project could be in violation of the Telecommunications Act. So it's not a local requirement. It's just how courts – it's the two-prong test that Ms. McDonald referred to that the courts have used.
But within our land use ordinance, which is the controlling body here, we have language that talks about – mitigating various kinds of impacts, visual, noise, others that any facility, but particularly.
Sure, and there's the required findings for a discretionary project, too.
Okay, which is not inconsistent with the neighborhood and not detrimental to the health, safety, welfare, and such like. I know others may want to comment. Mr. Chairman, I have some comments rather than questions. I'd defer if there are questions of staff at this
point. I just
do
have one
question. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Singewald, you spoke of a significant gap in coverage. How is that defined? I mean, we heard that from the area residents that they all have good coverage, yet we also heard that in one location there wasn't coverage. How do you define a significant gap?
You know, we don't make that decision on the local level. That is a judicial decision, and maybe Ms. McDonald wants to jump in here and talk about that.
I'm not aware of any hard and fast rules that the courts have come up with to determine, you know, what is a sufficient coverage and what is a significant gap. We do have to rely on to a certain extent on the applicant's representations of what their coverage objectives are, and then based on that, look at what evidence has been provided about how closely they are meeting that gap meeting those coverage objectives. And usually it involves studies of, you know, where do drop calls occur, and that's I think they usually call those propagation maps. It can come from somebody, you know, can you hear me, that type of study, but I'm sure there's more scientific ways to do it. But the evidence traditionally comes from the applicant themselves.
Okay, and we haven't really had that kind of information until just currently, or very recently, if at all. Arlen, is that correct?
Yeah, you know, if it helps the board, I can put up the radio frequency propagation maps that the applicant has submitted, and perhaps their RF engineer could speak to them.
Okay. Have you had a chance to evaluate that, or is that?
They submitted that with the initial application.
I see.
Again, when we review a project, one of the questions is not whether or not it closes a significant gap in coverage. That's not a consideration in our review of a project.
Okay, but yet we hear that that's a significant consideration on the part of siting a facility, but it's not something you review?
Correct. It's not something we review because it's not part of our ordinance.
Because it's part of the Federal Telecommunications.
If I were to sit here and say that they showed a significant gap in coverage, then I can't make that conclusion.
Okay. So we rely on the information that's submitted relative to that from the engineers and from the applicant, basically. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Teixeira?
Thank you, Chairman Hill. Arlen, if you could put the aerial map up one more time, please. Thank you. When you get to Site 7 that's shown on this map, where's access on this, and what's the current zoning, if we know on that property, what's going to be the conflict that we look at there in the future? Or is there, you know, proposed building close something coming in close by that we're going to have a problem with looking at this site?
The property is designated agriculture, and it gets access from Vineyard Drive. They must have an easement through this property here, which is a separate parcel, and I can't quite follow the road from this aerial, but there's access from Vineyard through this parcel to the project site. It's designated agriculture. A wireless facility isn't allowed use in the agriculture category. I'm not familiar with any, you know, pending residential development projects in the area.
On the right-hand side of the TAN project.
We can't actually take comments from the audience, so I appreciate it. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can point toward a direction here. We're in a very interesting situation. I'd just like to preface my comments by saying that the kind of alternatives analysis that we finally got today should have been at the Planning Commission. And I've been involved in a number of land use decisions on cell towers, and the ones that get contentious are largely the result of poor alternatives analysis going forward. And I know Ms. Knight's an agent for Verizon. I wish you would pass back to your client and others that you might work for that is the single weakest point of what telecommunications companies face when they come forward into our land use planning process, and I would hope that in the future they could do better. I can say we're in an interesting situation based on the testimony of the neighbors and the information presented. I believe that the proposed project, as it's presented here, does produce some intrusion onto a residential neighborhood. I'm not certain that that couldn't be fixed in a number of ways with another monopine instead of monopole. But among all that, the other thing that struck me is that the noise study submitted by the applicant really doesn't give us the information we need to make a decision as to whether this project meets our noise ordinance at the property line, which is the appropriate criterion. The interesting thing in this alternative analysis is that what we have is an alternative analysis that would be Exhibit A in supporting the alternative project on the Ames site. It shows that that is the least intrusive, and it was actually finally a good alternatives analysis that showed. It doesn't support the fact that the project before us is the least intrusive. The other interesting situation we find ourselves in is if you go to page 11 and look at the findings that staff had drafted for denial, they actually don't apply exactly based on just on information that we have heard today. And so in any case, if we were to take an action to deny, we would have to ask staff to recraft findings. My thought is to put forward what might seem like a classic politician's compromise, but what I'm contemplating is a tentative motion to deny based on the intrusions on the neighborhood, the failure to present a noise study, and the failure to show that the current project is the least intrusive, and a continuation for 6 months that would allow staff to craft findings supporting that denial. That may render that action moot in time, but I think it's important from my perspective. If I had to go thumbs up or thumbs down on this project today, I don't think it's met the necessary conditions of our land use ordinance. But since I think we have to continue or at least take a significant break here to get findings together to support that denial in a defensible way, why don't we continue it for a while?
Okay, so let's and I'll second that. It's a tentative denial. Coming back, I guess, at off calendar.
Let's go date certain if we might, Mr. Chairman. And
well, they're looking at what, 5-6 months? 6 months.
And we haven't set our calendar for 12 yet.
let me ask council, could we name a Tuesday in January, and if for some reason that isn't a meeting date, we could declare a special meeting if we needed to?
Yes, that would be appropriate.
Okay, and it's not
as long as it's a Tuesday.
It's not January. I know you got busy schedule others, and actually that would be March. So I would look for the last Tuesday in March. I'd move tentative denial of the project based on findings to be crafted on the points that I read into the record, and continuation to the last Tuesday in March.
Okay.
May I make a suggestion about that Tuesday? I'm thinking that, without the calendar in front of me, that March might have five Tuesdays, as it sometimes does. So maybe the fourth Tuesday would just be safer.
Okay.
The good news is there's only four Tuesdays in March of 2012, and the date would be the 27th.
Okay.
That's a nice acceptable symmetry to it, doesn't it?
And I would also, yes, okay, and I've seconded that. And I would just say to Ms. Knight, if when we come back on that, if you could do with anyone else a better job of reaching out to the neighbors in the alternative that you are hoping to have secured for that date, so that in the event that we might actually not have opposition, and especially not have opposition from people who weren't aware of this, that would be most helpful. So I'll call for the question and a roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank everybody for coming. I appreciate your patience and your help with this, and wish you a good evening. We will be adjourned until next Tuesday.
All
right. And that got me thinking. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing it.